Okay, the meeting will come to order. Representative Bunt, House File 1621. And then the Winkler bill will be sent.
No, Jesse, thank you.
Representative Bunn, Representative Paymar moves House File. Oh, we don't have the bill yet, so we can't vote. It's an informational hearing, sorry.
Mr. Chair, the bill was referred to your committee and health policy last Thursday evening, formally at the end of the committee. So I had understood that this would now be a formal hearing by you and the committee, and we also have an amendment before you to the bill as well. So why you wouldn't have the bill, I have no idea. I thought that would be through the staff process to receive the bill. You should also receive the amendment to the bill this afternoon.
You have the bill?
Do you also have the A2 amendment, the office amendment?
Right here.
That should come this afternoon.
We need more than
a copy of the bill that's in the school.
Yes, right here. Mr. Chair, please.
Okay, so you have to put the bill. Okay, so apparently the jackets are someplace in route. So, Representative Bunn, this one goes. Does this go to the floor?
This goes to finance, my understanding. It's deferred back to finance.
Okay. Representative Paymar moves 1621 to go to finance. Okay, Representative Bunn, my understanding. Oh, you want to put on an amendment to get it in the shape you wanted?
Correct.
It's
the A2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Paymar moves the A2 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Okay, there it is. And I believe this is only in the Committee for Data Practices. Is that the reason?
Correct, that was my understanding.
Could you explain that part of the bill then?
Yes, well, I think I'll explain it partly in relation to the amendment, because the amendment addresses those portions of the bill primarily. This bill did go through the Senate Judiciary to take up some of the issues regarding data privacy, those kinds of things. So let me say a few words about the bill so we have a context in which we're talking about data and data practice and data privacy. This is a bill that addresses public health issues. It's the basic public health protection of our citizens. It is a bill that proposes two programs. One, which is health tracking, which is to have our agency heads work together using public data to coordinate and analyze what's needed in these areas, health tracking. And then the second portion has to do with biomonitoring, and that's actually looking at biological specimens from human beings. So obviously when we're talking about, whether we're talking about collecting health tracking data, or we're talking about collecting some voluntary biological specimens, there are issues in terms of the handling of that data and information, and also issues with respect to the privacy and confidentiality kinds of things. And that's where the data practices comes to bear. With regards to the data practices issues, I want to talk about the amendment. The amendment was based on issues brought up in the Senate, and the language in the amendment is to make the bill comply with current data practices law. Okay? So everything on this list, would you like me to go through line by line or not?
Preferably not.
Okay, preferably not. Okay, everything on this amendment is in relation to bringing the bill in into to meet current best practice of law, except for one, line 1.10 on the amendment. It's deleting the phrase healthcare referrals, and I can talk about that if you'd like later, but everything else has to do with bringing in drafting the Office of Safe Practice Clause. In particular, I want to point out under the health tracking portion of this bill, they are going to facilitate dissemination of public health tracking data to public and researchers. In regards to data practices issues, while the chair confers. I don't know if I should be waiting in line.
Go ahead.
Okay. With regards to data practices issue, the key element here is this is dissemination of public health tracking data. And only information that is currently shared among agencies and that is public will be subject to what's going on in this bill with respect to health tracking. With regards to the biomonitoring program, the key elements are that they are going to conduct biomonitoring groups, and that it is voluntary, that it will be subject to the protocols that are in place for management and oversight of such collection of specimens, and in particular that it will adhere to CDC and NIH protocols on these issues. So that's going to be data practices portion of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions regarding the bill? Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3, under the biomonitoring lines 23 and 24, will the pregnant women and minors be on a voluntary basis as well?
Yes, one of the lines in the amendment inserts after the word minors on a voluntary basis.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I came in late. Thank you.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bunn, first I'd like to thank you for bringing this forward. I especially am in favor of this bill per section 3, subdivision 1.3, dealing with chloroform chemicals. I appreciate that. The ability to hopefully, when this does become law, be able to have a long-term look at any effects that may have, especially with the contamination in our groundwater in my area. So I'd just like to thank you for bringing that forward and all your work on this.
Okay, Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out what, you know, is the bill here, is it not here? I understand from Mr. Baldwin that it may have been referred this morning. It's not showing up on the website. We've got it up right here. We're looking at it right now. I understand you don't have the jackets. You know, I think we've had the testimony. I guess my preference, my recommendation, Mr. Chair, would be rather than vote this bill out tonight, that we make sure that this committee actually has possession of the bill before we act on it. And if somebody has the blue sheets from the floor this morning and I can look at that, then fine. But absent that, Mr. Chair, I think we lay it over until tomorrow, and we don't have to have the hearing again. We can probably just, we can vote on it and move it out tomorrow. But I don't know that the committee can even take action on this bill, whether it's the amendment that we've already put on or a vote on the bill. I'm not trying to bog this down, but I don't know that we even have the bill.
What I was thinking of doing was taking a vote, and then if we don't have the authority to do it, just do it again when it comes. That was one way we could handle it. And there's been things that haven't been on the website that they're behind, unfortunately, and we're finding that out at different times this year.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to be too partisan, but I think we might have raised that point back when we were doing rules and a few other things around here, but I'll defer to Representative Emmer here, but I believe he's going to present it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn, isn't this the very bill that we had up in the Health Committee the other night that we didn't have the jackets, or is this a different
one?
No,
it's a completely different bill. Chair Mulry, I'm confused by this word jackets. I mean, this bill was has been introduced long ago. We formally heard the bill Thursday evening and approved it, passed it on to this committee with recommendations. So I don't know what the process was supposed to be between then and to get it formally referred to you. Since you all requested me to have the hearing tonight, I assumed you had gotten that referral. So This is not that bill.
No. Well, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Bund, I didn't think so, but in reading it and hearing this, it seems to be deja vu or whatever you call it.
Totally unrelated.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chairman, you kind of went over it, but I'm still not sure I understand what's even in this bill. It's the Data Practices Act, and we're dealing with minors. Are we expanding the Data Practices Act? Are we staying consistent so proper things are private? Try it again on you.
Chair Mullen.
I've got three people talking to me at once, and it's hard to keep track of what's going on. Representative Bunn, are you responding to?
I was trying to respond to the question.
Sorry.
Although, Chair Mullen, he's asking me, well, what's really going on? Well, I was really never asked to present the bill. I was just asked to comment on the data practice force. I'd assumed I was going to present the whole bill and then within that talk about the data practices.
Okay.
But that's not what I was instructed to do, so I went right to the data practices.
And that's what we thought was going to happen.
So.
Representative Bynum, go ahead and
take the larger context of the bill. And in terms of your, specifically your question, everything in this bill conforms to data practices law, and that's what we were doing with the amendments to make sure that it did. So, no, we're not changing any data practices law. We're not amending any data practices law. We're just making sure the bill we have here, that is a new proposal to have Department of Health engage in a health tracking program and also by monitoring program, that's in conformance with those laws. So that's the part of it. Would you like to hear me do a brief presentation about the bill itself?
Sure. Do the members want to hear a brief presentation on the bill? I'm not hearing a grand acclamation in favor of that. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my understanding is that this bill is here for purposes of the omnibus data practices bill, then I would imagine that that's the portion that you'd need to know about. And I guess in my opinion, it wouldn't matter if we came back tomorrow and just laid that portion of it over for possible inclusion.
I
tomorrow,
think
just that, procedurally, that seems...
I think that maybe, if that's okay, we'll just... rather than arguing about whether the bill is here for 20 minutes or something, let's just take it up again tomorrow, pass the bill out, and lay it over for possible inclusion of section that's in the data practices. Is that okay with everybody? So we're going to keep going on. Oh, Mr. Neumeister, did you want to speak on the... Okay, sorry. We'll get that in tonight then, so that we have those. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on the bill? Okay, Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. The only concern I have about this bill is that I think it's important for you as committee members to make decisions, informed decisions. On pages 5, line 13, 14, and 15, it's one of the key parts of this bill. One of the things that we don't want to have as a state is have people ask for, even voluntary, items about themselves when there's not protections. We know the history of our country when state entities and other folks do research. So we're on those lines. I think there's some language that says protocols from the National Institute of Health. I think before you pass the bill along, it's important to get what those protocols are specifically, so at least you have knowledge of that. And what some of those are on a national level is that there is true informed consent by the individual. It's not just little, you know, basic informed consent, but informed consent, which is different than when you do informed consent on data practices. There's a difference between data practices and informed consent, and when you start doing research about informed consent. So that's my only point, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. An informational hearing can be nice and helpful and all that, but you also, not in the quickness of doing things, not know what this may, that to me is a major key, that you understand.
Representative, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Neumeister, I'd like to know what your opinion is, what's in those protocols that don't fit or that is evil.
Mr. Neumeister?
From my understanding, and I shared this, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the people that were forwarding this bill, I suggested to them what they might want to do is take a look at national recommendations or national protocols. One of the things that would be, it's a little bit more in depth, like for an example, is rather than say, could you please sign this consent, because we just need to, for your information, what a Institute of Health kind of consent is, we'd like to be able to take this information. This is an agreement. It's voluntary. This is what we're, real specifically, what we're going to do with it. We're going to inform you about what the result would be. It's sort of like more of an understanding, so the individual knows, because this would be data taken from them that could be used also for other purposes other than the purposes expressed in the bill. It's taking your fluid. It's taking something from your body. So those are the protocols. I haven't seen them for a while. I encourage the people who are putting this bill together to get that data so that it can be expressed to the policymakers. On the Senate side, they didn't have that data at that time. This is sort of like the last stop before it gets into a floor kind of situation. And all I'm saying is I think that information needs to be shared with you in detail. Those are
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Neumeister, I mean, it sounds to me like you're endorsing the language in the bill. Is that help me understand if that's not the case, because that's what I'm hearing you say. I mean, the bill says that the informed consent used for the program must meet the informed consent protocols developed by the NIH. And I hear you talking about those, what I interpret to be favorable terms. If I'm not correct, can you please help me understand
your position? Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, I haven't seen them in almost 10 years.
Okay.
I indicated to the people who are putting this bill together and working with their authors, that's nice to have, but you need to do the homework to be able to get that in there. Up to this date, publicly, I have not seen the homework presented to a group of legislators so that you as legislators are informed what those protocols are. I support and what I understand, but they have to get that to you so that in the rush, in 3 days from now, 2 days ago from now, you don't blindly, without knowing what those protocols are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe both last Thursday evening, but also we can do it tonight, we have several staff from the health department here who I'm sure could describe to you. First of all, I think you're correct, Mr. Cole, that he was basically saying the NIH has a very high bar for informed consent and what it involves and what would be said to the individual at the time that they consent. But I would ask that, if you don't mind, we'll have Director Link Stein call among the staff to describe that informed consent to you if you would like to.
Very short.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Link Stein. I'm the Division Director for Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I do have an expert on our informed consent procedures and the National Institute of Health protocols available to testify if that's desired. We do have one page handout that we would be able to provide to the committee that talks about these protocols. Simply stated, it's very clear in the design of any biomonitoring or data collection process involving private information on individuals, how the data will be used, and the individuals participating in that process are informed how the data will be used exclusively and expressly, so that there's no additional purposes beyond those expressed in our informed consent document that we would use that information for. So we could certainly provide a copy of the summary that we've got here, but having said that, if there's additional questions, I have an expert who can answer additional questions.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Can you also, and I don't need to, I'm not asking to take committee time right now, but before this moves out of here in what I presume is going to be an omnibus data practices bill, I guess I think Mr. Neumeister raises a valid point. Let's actually see the NIH protocols. I don't know if it's published in the CFR or where they're published, but can you show me the actual document that lays it out, or send me an email, get that information to me, so that we can see exactly what it is we're going. I think Mr. Neumeister raises a good point. I mean, I think he says NIH is generally pretty good, but let's confirm that and not base it just off of his recollection of what he saw 10 years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will do that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, we'll move on. Thank you, Representative Bond. And,
thank you, Chair Mullen.
Let's see. We promised Representative Winkler, is he there? And then after that would be Representative Mariani. Representative Lilly moves House File 1896. Representative Winkler, just go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1896, first I would request your favorable consideration. It establishes a legislative commission on terror and disaster preparedness for the state of Minnesota. The backdrop of this is that I think we're all pretty familiar with the 9/11 Commission report and the recommendations that it made for legislative change that are only now making their way through the Congress. We've seen since that time Hurricane Katrina and the challenges that the federal government faces and certainly state and local government in dealing with major disasters. And we've also seen the challenges that FEMA has faced in recent years, as well as the Department of Homeland Security, in simply getting up and running and providing a coordinated and effective Homeland Security policy. In the state of Minnesota every year, we see, maybe not every year, but frequently enough, and certainly this year, we see floods and tornadoes. We have the constant and recurring threat of disease outbreaks, whether it's SARS or the avian flu or just another flu pandemic. Such as we've seen in the past, and we have the possibility of a terrorist attack in the state of Minnesota, which certainly we should not forget about. I think the ultimate conclusion from what's been going on in Washington and what we see in the states is that each state has to be primarily responsible for protecting its citizens against disasters, preventing those disasters to the extent possible, and being certain that we're prepared to deal with the outcomes of those disasters. Today, in Minnesota, and in most states, probably all states, much of this preparation and prevention work is siloed in various state agencies, state and local government, public-private partnerships, hospital associations, etc. And much of their work is focused on disaster management rather than prevention. The Legislative Commission would be charged with a comparative analysis of risks facing Minnesota, both as to likelihood and potential severity. It would be charged with oversight of state government agencies, Department of Health, Department of Public Safety, in the ways in which they are preparing us and making sure that there is adequate cross-agency coordination on a number of areas. And it would also be responsible for recommending policy changes to the Minnesota legislature to adopt, and in fact requires an annual report. I think the point here is that we are going to have limited dollars to allocate to disaster or terrorism prevention and recovery, and we need to make sure that that is being spent well and effectively and considers all the potential threats from disaster and terrorism that Minnesota faces. Unfortunately, Dr. Mike Osterholm could not be here tonight. He is supportive of the bill because of a family medical emergency, was not available to testify. But he is supportive of the bill and is one of the people who brought this forward. With me is Jeff Sparks, who is the immediate past CEO of the Hennepin County Medical Center and has been one of the state's leading professionals dealing with disaster recovery and in all of the various issues that we'll face if something major happens.
So we have to deal with him instead of Oscar Holmes tonight. Go ahead, Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chairman, members, I shall attempt to be terse. if not pithy. In any case, I think I need to put the appropriate disclaimer on this that I'm acting tonight as a private citizen, and my views do not represent either Hennepin County or Hennepin County Medical Centers. I would like to note first that a fair amount of work has been done at both the state and regional level on typically on disaster management. One example would be the 800 megahertz communication system, which gives local and state government dedicated communications infrastructure for managing these kinds of events. The second example I would bring up is the Metropolitan Hospital Compact, which 19 of the metropolitan area hospitals have signed, and it's basically a protocol on how they would jointly use their available resources in the event of a disaster. Basically, you have two kinds of disasters. Natural disasters, whether that's fire, flood, tornado, or disease outbreak, and then those that are created by humans. And we're now all too well acquainted with what you can see with explosions, release of toxins, and fortunately haven't seen yet the creation of a virulent disease. We could ask ourselves the question, do we want to leave our fate in federal hands and wait for them to help us in the event of a disaster? I think the prudent answer to that is we better do what we can for ourselves while we have the opportunity. And most of our planning today has focused on recovery from disasters. And as Representative Winkler pointed out, one of the foci of this bill is to start working on mitigating risk that we can identify in advance, both public and private, and that we also need to have an overall high-level look at the efforts that have been done by various state departments and local units of government. If I may use an analogy from a fire department, actually this did occur up in Winnipeg, Canada. They spent years reducing their response time to fires and improving their effectiveness of putting them up. Finally, somebody in the department had a brilliant idea. Perhaps we ought to work on preventing fires. And they systematically worked with city code enforcement and other mechanisms, and over the course of 5 years, reduced the total fire calls by 50%. I think any citizen in Winnipeg was darn happy to not see a fire department pulling up in front of their place of business or their home as a result of that work. Finally, as a result of whatever work we would do with this commission, it would presumably make some recommendations on state policy and possibly appropriations to deal with the risks and vulnerabilities and how to reduce those. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have an amendment, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose an oral amendment that I believe the author is okay with. That is on line 1.6, 1.8, and 3.2 to delete the word terror and insert the word terrorism. I think it just more accurately reflects, I'm a co-author on the bill, and more accurately reflects the intent of the commission. And also on line 1.2 in the title of the bill, change the word terror to terrorism.
Representative Winkler, do you want to make that your, or I guess?
I will move that verbal amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is that okay with you?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a dog in the fight between terror or terrorism.
All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Is there any opposition to this bill? Are there any questions? Representative Villafora.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, it looks to me like a lot of the things this commission would do, the Department of Public Safety ought to be doing, especially the commissioner anyway. What is it that the commissioner of public safety is not doing that merits a $1.8 million appropriation for another governmental body?
Representative Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, I'm not the best person to answer what the Department of Public Safety specifically is not doing. The issue is how well coordinated with the Department of Health is the Department of Public Safety. How do we weigh the comparative risk of avian flu, which the Department of Public Health has some concern about, versus a tornado or a flood or an act of terrorism. Which is more likely? Which is the greater threat? How do we make recommendations for policy change without having somebody who has cross-jurisdictional oversight and responsibility for addressing those questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the Marine Corps, they could talk to each other, and they talk to each other regularly. I'll pass on that. Obviously, I'm not sure, convinced that this commission is needed. I also had questions, Representative Winkler, lines 2.9 and 10. I'm wondering what citizen members selected solely by the speaker to each and the majority leader to each, what they would bring to a panel, from what you're telling me, that needs some type of relevant expertise. Or do we get four average citizens who basically would be political appointees? What do they bring to the commission?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative De La Forest, it is my understanding that it is much in custom these days to add citizens to legislative task forces and commissions, and the purpose there is simply to be consistent with what current policy or what current political positions have been to include citizen members. I don't think it's unreasonable that the voice of the public should be included, and they don't simply have to be experts in the field in order to have that participation. And simply because they are appointed by the legislative body leaders, I don't think makes it necessarily more political. The interest and the incentive for everyone involved in this would be to make good policy suggestions and recommendations, because if something did happen, it would be responsibility and blame would be quickly parceled out, and purely political appointments to commissions or agencies that are tasked with disaster management certainly would not be looked upon favorably, as we've seen nationally.
Mr. Chair, similar concerns. 1.8 million to have a commission to do what we've been able to do thus far without it. And why aren't we doing this thing? Perhaps we ought to take the 1.8 million out of their budget and redefine what they're supposed to be doing. We've also got the Department of Emergency Management, and that is exactly what they're supposed to be doing. I've worked with them when we've had floods. I've worked with them when we've had other crises in my area, and seen what they've done in other, with tornadoes and things like that. And what aren't they doing that this commission is now? It seems to me like we've just got duplication on duplication, and a million eight is a lot of money to go to something else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, we could have a discussion about what the appropriate level of appropriation would be, although I think that would be better suited in a finance committee. And as for the issue of what the Department of Emergency Management does, I mean, what we've already discussed here is that they're charged with managing existing emergencies, not with preventing the various kinds of disasters that could occur and allocating, making suggestions for allocating resources to prevent them. As to specifically what's not happening, and some concrete examples, I would ask Mr. Sparks to describe that in a little bit more color.
Mr. Sparks. Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, in the past, I've been through a number of planning exercises where one is shocked at the end at the conflict between various jurisdictions while you're going through the planning or you're going through an actual exercise. And my view has been that for some time we're lacking some overall guidance at the highest level here from the legislature on how we can deal with some of these jurisdictional issues.
Okay, Mr. Weider.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, this organization, can it sue and be sued?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I don't believe that's one of its specific powers or duties. Presumably, unless it was, unless there was some overall assumption in law that legislative commissions can sue or be sued, I would assume that not to be the case, but I'm not an expert on legislative commissions.
For our staff, is probably the ones that could answer this.
Okay.
That was my office of legal analysis.
To check with other members of their staff.
Oh, I don't get an answer tonight, then? Because I have another question, Mr. Chairman. It kind of follows along the same lines. I'd love to know if they can be sued or if they can sue someone else. Representative Winkler, is this organization going to end up securing its own office space and its own staff and its own equipment, those sorts of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I think what you're sort of getting to is what would the appropriation be used for, and is this sort of an opportunity to create a job space for somebody? And the answer would be no. I don't know what the if office space is unavailable at the Capitol Complex and they would need to have some sort of office in order to conduct their operations, I would assume that some of the money would be available for that. The main issue really is, and the reason why there's an appropriation here, is that the answers to many of these questions don't necessarily, the expertise doesn't necessarily reside entirely in the state of Minnesota, and there's a great deal of national discussion, national expertise in dealing with the range of issues involved. And to have the staff to be able to really collect the information and provide the thorough analysis that I think it requires some amount of appropriation.
Mr. Chair,
a couple more minutes.
Well, the problem is, Mr. Chair, he hasn't answered my question, and it's nice to talk about expertise and all these things out here somewhere, but perhaps the detailed analysis that you just referred to should be done on this before we go pursuing a $1.8 million appropriation without knowing what kind of staff are we going to use, what kind of office space are we going to use, can this outfit be sued or sue other people, can this outfit retain its own counsel even though it's got the Attorney General or a representative designee from the Attorney General's office on its list. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, that's a statement. This is a statement of frustration, because I think these things should be determined before we get this kind of a request. If you look under Subdivision 3 where it says compensation, I've been seeing this a lot, where we get all these new commissions and boards and everything else, and then we get this one or two line statement. Compensation of legislative members is provided in Section 3.101, and then compensation of the remaining members is provided in 15.0575. Representative Winkler, are we creating yet another organization that will pay per diem and other related expenses for work on behalf of the state that we should all be doing here?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I would agree that we should all be doing this kind of work here, but there hasn't been a great deal of it done. Your questions are ones that are, I think, good questions for the Government Operations Committee, which we which we're going to, and for State Government Finance. And if you'd like to see a detailed proposal of what $1.8 million could be spent on for those committees, I'd be happy to provide them. I think that, in my mind and my understanding, the question for this committee is it a good idea for the state of Minnesota to be thoughtful and deliberative about how we address these kinds of threats and allocate our resources effectively in an area that is particularly challenged by jurisdictional boundaries, TERP, and the failure to compare all the various things that could happen and try to assign risk prevention and recovery resources effectively.
Okay, we're going to have to move on this. We're 5 minutes over on this one. So, I'll call
Mr. Chair, just on the record, can I make sure that I get that list before it gets to the next committee hearing from Representative Winkler?
Representative Emmer, I guess he wants it on the record that you'll get on the list before it goes to Government Operations, which is what it's going to.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative West,
let's put another question, but are you saying we can't ask any more questions?
Well, yes, we did put in time limits on things, and so we're already 5 minutes over. We can't, at this year point in the year, just spend 3 hours on some of these bills.
Mr. Chairman, there's bills that seem to have problems that we might need to spend more than 5 minutes on them.
Well, Representative, all the questions have been what really should be in the Government Operations Committee, since they handle those issues. Representative, we're going to have to vote on this. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. The motion was by Representative Lilly to pass it as amended and refer it to government operations. I'm sorry. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
Okay, carry. Thank you. You're on your way, and try to provide the information you requested before the next meeting, and also provide it to Representative Turner and to Dennis Burton, and he can get it to whoever wants it. Okay. Representative Payman, you're up.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief.
Just one question. Is there any opposition to this bill tonight?
This is okay.
Representative Paymer, this one.
Chair, I'd like to the floor. Yeah, I'd like to move House File 772 and recommend that it go to the judge.
Okay, we'll set about 7 minutes and then 3 minutes for discussion.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment that you should have in the packet, the 2A4 amendment.
Yes, we do have that.
Okay, and basically what that says, Mr. Chair, is that, well, if I could move the amendment, and I'll explain it.
Go ahead and move it.
I move the A4 amendment, and I also have an oral amendment on page 2 of the bill.
Can we do one at a time?
Certainly.
Okay, to get it in the shape the author wants, he moves the A4 amendment. All in favor of that say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Okay.
Then, Mr. Chair, members, I have an oral amendment on page 2 of the bill. The effective date is January
2009.
Instead of 2008.
Representative Paymar moves an oral amendment on line 2.25. Changing 2008 to 2009 to get in the shape he wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Carries. Go ahead and present yourself.
Chair, briefly, I know we don't have a lot of time. House File 272 is a bill that came to me from a constituent who's sitting right next to me, Toby Pearson, whose wife was tragically died in a plane crash in northern Minnesota. And her two children.
Who are
in the bathroom. who survived the plane crash. And Mr. Pearson has brought this bill to me, and as amended, the bill does two things. First, it seeks to raise the minimum amount of insurance required to fly an airplane. The insurance industry is in agreement to these levels. As I understand it, most pilots carry more insurance coverage than these minimums, but these minimums have not been addressed since 1976. Second, with the amendment that we adopted, we're basically setting up a process where aircraft owners, pilots, insurance companies, and other interested parties can examine related issues. As some of you who sit on the Commerce Committee know, we were stuck on language regarding third-party liability and clarification of the duties and obligations of the insured. The insurance industry and pilots were concerned about that provision, and we think that it needs more work. So that's what the amendment basically did. We have representatives from the insurance industry as well as from the pilot groups here who are now in support of the bill. And Mr. Pearson, if you want to say a couple. And also the effective date is to give the pilots enough time to renew. So that was the purpose of that oral amendment. So Mr. Pearson's here if you have any questions or if you want to make a statement.
I just want to make a very brief statement. Sounds like that's finally agreed on. It was quite a chore in Congress. I heard it there, but Mr. Pearson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, it did come up in Commerce a couple weeks ago, and the past weeks, all the interested parties, the insurance reps, the pilots, myself, and some other legislators have been having very productive conversations regarding the language proposal. We didn't think that we were going to be able to get it completed in time to meet all the deadlines, so we arranged instead to have the interim hearing meeting and conferring to try to arrive at some agreement regarding third-party liability, insureds and insureds. We're not tied to any outcome as far as the language goes, but we felt it necessary to get more voices involved in the conversation so we could move forward with what we hope is a better legislation at the end. So we would report back November 15th as to what our findings are in the anticipation of, if there are productive findings, to move forward next year.
Okay, I'll ask once again, is there any opponents? Okay, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, or maybe you need to bring, maybe you need to phone a friend and get either the insurance industry or the pilots up. I appreciate the work that's been done on this. My only question is, I intend to vote for the bill, but my only question is, do we have any sense what raising the limits from $25,000 to $100,000, and $50,000 to $300,000, what that's going to do to rates for individual pilots? Since this got worked out, I've heard from essentially no one, although I did receive an email today from a guy who has a crop dusting plane and is concerned about rates and what this is going to do to it. So I don't know if you can address
I think that's a fair. Mr. Pearson has been doing the negotiating with the insurance.
Great. Mr. Payne.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I think part of their concern came to us, and that's why we changed the effective date to 2009, because we hadn't heard from all of the aerial applicators previously, and they just came to the table recently. We wanted to make sure that the effective date of it would allow us to look at that. Previously, all the pilots that we had heard from in the Pilots Association had signed off on the language, so everybody was in agreement with the language as it is. It was our understanding that few, if any, would write insurance below those amounts to start with. So.
Mr. Chair, I just don't. I'm gonna support the bill going out of here. I'll follow up with my constituent on that issue. If there continues to be an issue, Representative Paymar, I know you've been willing to work on this bill as it's moved forward, and I'll follow up with you if there are any problems. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
to that point, maybe you don't have a number. It'd be nice if somebody from the insurance industry could say, what would you be paying for that kind of coverage today, and what would it cost under this new scenario? Hypothetically, I mean, I realize they aren't going to get to the penny, and there might be.
State your name.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Mark Colden. I represent the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The Trade Association represents most of the insurers in Minnesota. We really don't know the answer to that question, because we know that in the current marketplace, most pilots currently purchase coverage that is including the limits that are in the bill. So the minimum limit has been raised to, in the bill, $100,000, which is what is pretty much sold in the marketplace now. So the effect on premiums would probably be pretty negligible, since most policies cover that amount anyway, so we don't think that there's going to be a dramatic increase in premiums. But again, this is a study commission. We can certainly study the issues and talk about some of these things in the process.
Okay, are there any other questions?
So, Mr. Chair, what are they paying for that policy today? The $100,000 minimum that they typically are buying today. Any ideas that $1,000 a year, $5,000, $25,000?
Mr. Chairman, members, I do not know. I don't have the answer to that. I do know that I don't have a good example of what it would cost, because we don't know what the underwriting is, and it would really depend on the variables in the marketplace in terms of the individual person who's applying for the policy and what risk they represent. So it would be pretty difficult to say. We don't have that data right now, but it would be tough to say what the average is right now, because we don't have it.
Okay. Representative Paymar, do you want to come back? No further questions. Okay.
Renew my motion to move House File 772 as amended to the General Register.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Carries. Representative Coles, do you want to do yours?
1465. I don't know if Mr. Chair, the Department of Corrections is here or not. I know they had an issue that they had given me a call about
a public bill.
Representative Paul, if you want to move your bill while you're here,
I move House File 1465. The recommended pass, and I believe probably the finances.
I believe that would have to go word of the commission.
I think it probably does.
I'm pretty sure it does. So, Representative Paul moves the 1465 for passage and referral to finance committee. Representative Paul, why don't you go ahead while we're waiting for us?
Not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1465 addresses an issue that we heard about in this committee earlier this year, and we also heard about in the finance committee. The issue is how county jails calculate per diem and how they report that. How do we as policymakers compare what one county is telling us their per diem rate is as opposed to another county? What the bill provides for is that the Department of Corrections, as it's currently written, it provides that the Department of Corrections would develop a uniform method to calculate the average per diem. This has been done elsewhere. Mr. Carter provided me with some samples of what's been done in a few other states. So I'm not asking the department to create something out of whole cloth. There's examples out there that they can certainly look to. I did receive a message from Ms. Cox with the department earlier today. She indicated that there's some interest in trying to potentially get the Sheriff's Association to do this as opposed to the department. They believe that it would make more sense for the sheriffs to do this. I haven't had a chance to talk with the sheriff, so I don't know if it's something they're willing to do or not. I guess, members, I don't really care who does this. I just think we ought to have a uniform way in which our counties provide information to the state so that we as policymakers can compare apples to apples when we're talking about per diem rates at our county facilities. So whether it's ultimately done by the Department of Corrections or by the Sheriff's Association, I guess I don't really have a strong preference. And since it is being sent to Chair Paymar's committee, there's still time to work on this. So I don't know if the department came in or not and wants to talk to it now or wants to talk to it later, but I want one set of data that we can all look at and understand and compare apples to apples.
Representative Cole, is that something that Representative Hillstrom's bringing up for a couple of years to do that? Is there any questions on this bill? Okay, all in favor of Representative Coles renews his motion to pass 1465 and send it to finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, carries. Representative Mariani. Representative Johnson, would you move this bill?
Yes.
Representative Johnson moves House File 1438. And it's for the floor, for passage and to go to the floor.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for moving this bill. Frankly, this is the kind of bill that probably needs a longer discussion than we're going to be able to commit to it this evening, but we're all victims of our schedule and our deadlines, and like many of you, I'm sitting in two or three committees this evening. At first glance, the bill probably asks you to do something that is counterintuitive because it deals with the Real ID Act, which was passed in 2005, which after all, members, was passed with the notion that we were going to create greater protection and security for Americans through this major federal imposition on states' prerogatives. Closer scrutiny, however, members, tells us that the federal mandate is seriously flawed, raises a number of issues, quite frankly, that are neither Republican or Democrat partisan issues. They're issues, I think, primarily related to those who care about our liberties and our privacy as Americans, but also creates an incredibly huge unfunded mandate on all states, including our state. The REAL ID Act of 2005 creates a national standard for the issuance of state driver's licenses and ID cards. It creates members a de facto national identification card. It calls for an unprecedented, massive, centralized database that unifies this national ID card throughout the country. It imposes federal technology standards and verification procedures. Technology standards and verification procedures drafted by Congress, not by our state's capitals, on all state driver's licenses. Members, I've been a state representative for a number of years, and one of the things I've learned to do over time is to, quite frankly, jealously guard the prerogatives that are left to our states in terms of functions that are bona fide state functions. The REAL ID Act prescribes to our state what our state licenses and IDs should look like, what info should be collected and stored on those ID cards, how the information is verified, how the information is stored, how the information is read, and it also mandates that we be part of a huge national database system that currently does not exist. It requires sharing information through that system for all the information that we gather about our citizens and residents in that state with all other states throughout the union. It opens up a host of privacy issues and unauthorized access issues that can lead to very real ID theft, a growing white-collar crime in our society. In four areas, I want to highlight four areas for you. First is the cost issues related to the REAL ID Act. Minnesota estimates, you should have this handout, I hope, Mr. Chair and members. Maybe not, maybe that's still coming. We do have someone from our driver's license DMV Public Safety Department. But in Minnesota, we're talking about $10.3 million of one-time upfront costs that need to be absorbed in order to conform with the REAL ID mandates. In addition, members, there's $4.2 million each year for the next 4 years once the mandate kicks in, for a total of over $21 million. Members, in addition to that, we expect that there will be higher driver's license fees that are going to have to be imposed in order to cover some of these costs. Across the nation, it's been estimated by national groups like the National Governors Association, our own state, National Conference of State Legislators, that REAL ID will cost at least $11 billion to our states. For $11 billion, the federal government has put $40 million out there to help us. I hear that they're possibly thinking of raising that to $100 million to help the states with this unfunded mandate. It raises privacy issues because information will be available throughout our nation on this database, which I remind you has not yet been created. Nothing on this scale has ever been created. And that the information collected and mandated in that database could grow. And that's why there's a growing list of folks, and there's no partisanship to this, members. They range from gun ownership groups to librarians who are really concerned about a national database that has the capacity to have all sorts of things added to it using modern technology where anyone could simply, by swiping their driver's license, could have access to tons of information beyond the basic information of who you are and where you live. There are security issues with the single database system. There's basically a one-stop shop being created here for identity theft thieves who can hack anywhere in the United States, because after all 50 states are going to be linked to this massive database. There are implementation issues for every state. We're most likely going to have to add staff. We're going to have to train more staff because they're going to have to go through new and higher levels of verification, scanning, and storing of documents that we're currently not doing. And this will lead to a larger bureaucracy in our public safety and our motor vehicle driver's license issuing department. Yeah, Representative Badiani, but after all, this is going to make us all safer. Members, that's not proven. This, frankly, the act was passed as part of the Tsunami Relief Act. You all remember the Tsunami Relief Act. That's where we passed the 2005 Real ID Act. With very little public debate. New rules were just released just earlier this year. In fact, I think it was 30 days ago. It's 162 pages that states have yet to digest. Mr. Chair, I doubt that your committee has had a chance to look through that 162-page federal rules, but I suggest you look at them because the implications for our state and down the line for our finance committees are going to be potentially onerous. Congress is now having some growing doubts. As you can bet, Congress is not going to move particularly fast on this because, after all, when does Congress move particularly fast on anything? Members, ID documents don't reveal the evil intent that evildoers have. Evildoers will obtain false documents if that's what they need to do. Now, having said that, let me say, members, I think we should have good documents. Our state has made very aggressive efforts over the last few years to make better, verifiable, hard to duplicate, but not impossible, hard to duplicate documents as part of our efforts to raise the quality of identifying individuals who come forward for driver's license requests. We don't need a half-thought-out federal framework to do this work with all the potential privacy problems that it poses, especially if it's an unfunded mandate. This ID Act was originally scheduled to be enforced, I think I got these dates right, in May of 2008. It has been extended, I've been told, out to 2009. Members, recently the states of Maine and Idaho have passed memorials rejecting participation in this national ID card approach. There are currently, as we speak, 8 other states who have passed either memorials or statutes in at least one chamber, including the state of Arizona, Georgia, Montana, New Mexico, Utah, Vermont, Washington, and Wyoming. And I just checked today, and I think the Wyoming Senate actually did turn it down, although the House there did pass a rejection statute. There is legislation introduced in a number of other states. The bill very quite simply would call for noncompliance with the Real ID Act. I'm not going to pretend it's not a big step for us, members. And I certainly respect your desires to do with it as you wish. I think it's really important that we publicly state and we publicly engage in a real challenge to a mandate handed down by the federal government that has broad-reaching privacy issues for freedom-loving Americans and, in addition, has a huge unfunded mandate expectation of our states. So, members, that's basically it. I think there is one other person that wants to testify. I do believe there's someone here, public safety, that can answer some of the questions. They haven't taken a position one way or the other, but they have provided some information of cost and things that they expect they're going to have to do in response to the Real ID Act. So I'll stop there and see if anyone else wants to.
Okay, is there any opponents to this? You were standing.
Mr. Chair, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Okay.
Just one second.
I want to make sure that one of the opponents wanted to testify. Okay, Representative LaPointe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mariani, I like your bill. Would passing this bill jeopardize the state's receipt of any federal funding, and if so, what's the dollar number?
Mr. Chair, Representative LaForest, it's a good question. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Looks like, I'm sorry, why don't you just come up to Aunt Teresa Nelson, was it? Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative LaForest, there is no, this is an unfunded mandate, so there's no state money tied to it. The only impact for a state is that its citizens' licenses will not be recognized for the purposes of boarding airplanes, things of that nature. On the flip side, if enough states tell Congress that they are not going to adopt Real ID, it will force Congress to take a closer look at it and move implementation.
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. I just find it ironic. I would think then that you'd show something like a passport to get on an airplane, and probably the way you'd establish your identity for a passport is to show your state-issued driver's license, but I'm thinking about it too much.
Mr. Chair, okay, members, I don't know all the coercive elements that the federal government has used here, but obviously airports, post offices, any federal facility just to gain access to and services to, if it requires showing either a state ID card, it's also a pass ID card, or a driver's license in order to access service, that would be negated under Real ID if the state is not conforming.
Yes, Representative Mariani, I wondered how they were going to do that with the federal courts, since
it would affect federal courts, is my understanding.
If you're a defendant in a criminal case, can you not be tried then because you don't
have thought out congressional law.
Okay, then seeing no further, Representative Mari, Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass and send it to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I'm glad to work with any members that have questions about this.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen. Let's see. And I think we said about 6 minutes.
Sure.
And we'll have about 10, 12 minutes of discussion. Okay, Representative Thiessen, Representative Tamar, we'll move your...
Mr. Chair, I don't think the bill is actually in your...
Oh, that's... I'm sorry, this is one informational hearing. That's right. Sorry, Representative Thiessen, why don't you...
What? It's not been re-reported to the committee. Thank you, Mr.
Held up with everything else here. Representative Tisa, thank you for appearing so that we can get this one out of the way. Go ahead.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. And remember, this is the Stop on Red legislation that would allow for photo enforcement of red light runners in Minnesota. The engrossment before you, I just wanted to clarify that there are actually three amendments made in the engrossed version that you'll see when it comes in transportation. So when it comes to you in official form, there's an amendment that we put on that said that the violation is not going to go on the driver's record. And then there's a provision for an engineering study and a provision that vendors can't, the contract with the vendors of these vehicles can't be paid a commission based on how many violations they have, that it's not a per violation kind of payment system. But just so members are clear that those amendments were added in transportation finance. This is really about traffic safety and increasing traffic safety, Mr. Chair and members. We know it works. In Minneapolis, we had this. It had a 31% decrease in crashes and a 42% decrease in crashes in T-bone crashes, the kind of most dangerous type of crashes at intersections when this was enforced in Minneapolis. So it's about kind of really saving lives, avoiding injuries, avoiding property damages, and consistent with what other states have done. I think that there. Councilmember Ostro maybe address some of the other issues that have been raised, and then we can get to questions.
Okay, Mr. Ostro, or Council Member now, Ostro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm pleased to be able to be here today, and I appreciate Representative Thiessen bringing this bill forward with to your committee. I'm also joined by Mary Ellen Payne, who's the city attorney involved in this matter, and also Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt, who's in charge of our traffic division. And if it's all right, we'd like to maybe have them make a few comments as well. But Stop on Red is a statewide public safety initiative. I'm here tonight not only as a council member who led this effort on our city council, but I also am our representative to the League of Minnesota Cities that endorses this legislation. I also chair our Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee that also supports this legislation. Cities throughout this state want to have this tool to improve public safety. I also bring to you a perspective of the work I did before I was on the city council. I was a municipal prosecutor for the cities of Blaine and Little Canada, so I saw firsthand the havoc that red light running can have on citizens really throughout the region and the state. And Stop on Red really is a statewide public safety initiative. It saves lives. It prevents injuries. Just to repeat the numbers that Representative Thiessen gave you, 31% reduction in accidents, 42% reduction in T-bone accidents. That is unheard of for any other kind of public safety initiative. We had in the city of Minneapolis, we launched this program in the summer of 2005. In 8 months of operation, there were 25,000 violations that were issued. It's a program we believe is very, very effective and deserves support. We do have, as I mentioned, Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt here, who could speak to some of the issues about the impact this might have on personnel in the police department, as well as the issue of other means and other ways to prevent accidents not being successful. So,
you have about 2 minutes left.
Okay. And while Lieutenant Reinhardt is coming up, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that people understand that this. That moving in this direction, we have a lot of other very serious issues in Minneapolis related to public safety, particularly on the north side. And I acknowledge that and know that the police officers in Minneapolis and across the state, but in Minneapolis in particular, are doing heroic work on the north side, and we need to support them in as many ways as we can. And I hope that this legislature sees fit this session to find the resources, and maybe part of that, to find the resources that will help us achieve the goal of actually fighting serious crime throughout the city, but particularly on the north side.
That would be very helpful in view of what do we have, 8 of the 10 murders in the city are in my district or next to it. I can't remember your title, it's Reinhardt. But
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Greg Reinhardt, Minneapolis Police Department, and members of the committee. The Stop on Red program allowed us to redirect officers into the needed areas of Minneapolis for crime prevention. And at the time, I was the head of the traffic unit, and I can assure you, at that time, we increased the size of our traffic unit to deal with the second most voiced concern of livability issues in the city of Minneapolis, and that's traffic. Crime may go up and down, but traffic always seems to remain, and it is an issue that we work on. The Stop on Red program allowed me to take officers who may work high accident intersections, high incident occurrences of accidents at intersections, move them to other areas such as school zones or areas where there's a great deal of speeding. It worked. The statistics prove that it worked. We also show that in the past there have been discussions of, well, it's simply a case of bad engineering. Oh, yeah, and attach it maybe to the yellow cycle time or the red cycle time. There's been an 11-year study, I repeat, an 11-year study on the timing of traffic lights. It was done by the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and they showed that there was no significant benefit to public safety by moving to an all-red phase. Actually, I have a copy of that study here for you to look at. There are things that we can look at, but in my years of experience, I've never seen a change in driving behaviors. I'd rather not get any tickets at all. I'd rather have people to comply, to avoid, to obey the law, and not to crash into each other.
And we've tried through the four E's of traffic management, which would be emergency response, engineering, education, and enforcement, to affect people's driving behavior. And a very successful program. It works. We'll answer any other questions that you may have.
Okay, is there any opposition to this that wants to testify? Okay, Mr. Neumeister and Ms. Nelson, can you agree on a split, or do we just do three for each? Three each? Okay. Mr. Neumeier, then. Neumeister. You get 3 minutes, and she gets the other three.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a bad bill. What is the bill doing? The bill is putting technology together with enforcing a law, and enforcing it to a point to where you've got 26,000 type folks cited in 8 months. Minneapolis plans on putting in their contract up to maybe 46. So you're talking about thousands and thousands of people just in Minneapolis alone involving themselves in the criminal justice system. Secondly, other entities are going to be doing this. There are some concerns that I have that involve issues of due process, issues of surveillance, and just issues of where they want to tag the owner of the vehicle. Now, the Eakins case that they talk about, I have had an opportunity to read both briefs and the opinion. There's a difference when you put cameras in regards to using the point that you can use tag an owner using technology than tagging an owner and seeing go through a stoplight. The other thing that I do have concerns about, as I would like to highlight, is some of the differences that may be between local municipalities and some of the standards that they may use. Also, as you may know, a high percentage of people do sometimes may not pay their fines because they do believe that it's not them. These will go to search warrants. The other point is the bill talks about 21 days. It's very hard to remember after so many days when you get who had your car, what was the situations and all that. Differentiation between a minor offense by just going over the crosswalk versus going right through, or just doing a slow California stop. The other kinds of things is that it has no guarantee about what happens when there's something wrong with traffic. Sir, if you can tell me what my time, I'm trying to, in terms of the violation.
You've got another minute.
Okay. What happens when the equipment is not operational and not in real good shape? That has been some of the issues across some of the cities or the country. Also, in terms of that, and it hits me hard, is that they say, the proponents of this bill say it's for public safety. And granted, I know their heart is for public safety. But part of that heart is also saying this can be a hell of a revenue raiser. Again, $3.6 million is raised with vote 26. Now, it's a government revenue raiser. $2 million went to the state. $1 million approximately went to the city. If you have this statewide and if there's a safety concern, I say lower the fine like a number of states do, where they say $40, $50, $75 or whatever, and then make it totally civil in nature, where it can also not go to a criminal offense.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. I did prepare some written testimony. I don't know if it made it to you all, so I brought copies. If there's somebody that can give them to the members. And I'm just going to, I know that this is a very full agenda, so I'm just going to talk about two issues. The ACLU of Minnesota opposes this bill. And for probably two of the most important reasons. Number one, this would be an unprecedented act for the state of Minnesota to create photographic enforcement of
of laws, photographic enforcement of traffic laws. This is unprecedented in the state of Minnesota, and I believe that it's important for the legislature to have back up and have the policy discussion about whether or not we want to start using cameras to enforce our laws, and whether or not that's an appropriate place for the state to go. I assure you this is only the first step, and as has been experienced in other states, even though this bill limits it to stoplights, in other states they've expanded it to speeding, and who knows where it will end. But before taking that first step, I do urge the legislature to have a broader policy discussion about where we want cameras, when we want cameras, and for what purpose. The second concern that we have about this bill is that it imposes liability on the owner of the vehicle. As you may know, that is, there are a couple other statutes that's on the books that do impose liability on the owner of a vehicle. We submit that that should be the exception, not the trend or not the rule. And the difference in this case, in all those other cases, the individual is, or the vehicle is observed by a person who's in a position to judge whether or not, gosh, you know, sure they violated the law, but it probably wasn't avoided given the conditions of the road and things like that. And somebody on the ground is able to make that judgment and decide whether or not to impose a ticket. With photo enforcement, you don't have that situation. You have a camera that is photographing the violation, and we have concerns about that. We believe that it does turn due process on its head. The bill has made significant improvements with the amendments that take the bill from being reported on your driver's license. The citation is not reported on your driver's license. However, there's still an issue where a third misdemeanor or a third traffic violation on your driving record in 1 year is a misdemeanor, which means you're facing jail time. So let's say you've got somebody who has two speeding tickets, and within a year, maybe they go to Minneapolis and park in valet parking, and the valet gets a speeder or a red light ticket. They have no idea who's done it, and so they're facing owner liability and possible jail time because now it's a misdemeanor because they've had two speeding tickets. So, and that statute is 169.89, subdivision 1, small 2, that enhances it to a misdemeanor for that third violation. And that, this bill doesn't do anything to address that issue, so we do still have very strong due process.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Nelson, I have very big concern about what you raised, and I want to know the answer on that, because I was told that it could not count in any way against your driving offenses at any time, and I was also told that it wouldn't go against your insurance. So I want to know very much before I vote on this, because those were two of my absolute, if it does either of those, I was strongly against it. Representative Thiessen, do you want to address those two issues, and then we'll see what else members have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did... in the bill, it does say that a violation of the subdivision does not constitute grounds for revocation or suspension. So that is in the bill, and it also says specifically it doesn't go on the driving record. This is the first time this issue has been raised, and so I'm happy to address the issue before we get back to your committee for actual hearing on the bill. So I appreciate it.
You'll
first time I've heard of this. I understand.
Oh, it's for guarantee if there's any chance that this can ever count against your driving record or insurance. I know you're going to lose, and you don't have a big margin right now.
No, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. We will address that issue.
Okay. Are there other members with issues on this? Okay, then.
Could I just say a few things briefly in
sure,
response?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no,
yes.
That's fine. First of all,
very quickly.
Yes, the 26,000 traffic tickets or thereabouts that were issued, I think it's just important that members realize that those are actually people running red lights. They're violations, so that's kind of the extent. I think that more than anything defines the scope of the real problem we have. Surveillance, I just want to tell a little bit about how the cameras work. The cameras don't turn on until someone has actually crossed into the intersection after the light has turned red. It takes three photographs of the license of the vehicle, and then there's a 12-second video taken, which I think is important to one of the points that was raised with regard to that you're not observed by a person. Because the other thing that's important, and it's right here in the legislation, is that all this evidence is actually reviewed by a police officer before any decision about actually issuing a ticket is made. And so the police officer will be able to observe the conditions, etc. Now, what conditions would justify running the red light? I'm not sure. It's kind of a black and white or red and green or whatever the metaphor would be issue. The last thing on the revenue. So, you know, I don't think this is really surveillance in that sense, because it's only triggered when someone actually runs the red light, and then only for a short period of time after that, and it's reviewed by a police officer. With regard to the issue of being a revenue raiser, that's not really what this is about. I don't think it's in Minneapolis, the amount that was raised is, I believe the facts are, it's 1/3 of 1% of the public safety budget. You know, the city of Minneapolis, for whatever that's worth, is not balancing their public safety budget on this. Whether this money ought to be dedicated towards public safety, I think, is a good question. This will help. But the city, at least the city of Minneapolis, is not in this for the money. So I guess those are the points that I'd like to make.
Well, in actuality, Representative Thiessen, the state gets money out of if we allow this. So.
The state gets more money than the city, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And we also get money we're probably not getting now, most of it. One issue that was raised is the judgment call. And is there a way that the police officer can back up the tape so that when he can see how far, in other words, if it just takes the photo at the time they enter the intersection, that doesn't tell him how far, whether a person was very close to it or coming along, whether it had turned a long time before.
I'm going to let the experts explain that, if I could.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the system works, it has a series of loops in the roadways. You're familiar when you approach a red light and sometimes you drive over the loops and it'll register whether your vehicle's there or not and the lights change. It's the same principle that's been in use for about 50 years. When a vehicle is approaching a red light and is traveling at a speed that is higher than able to stop in the distance that the loops are spaced out, it's the same, using the same math they taught us in seventh grade, time, distance, and speed, and I never get those questions right on a test, but it calculates the speed of the vehicle, and it understands that the vehicle is not going to be able to stop before the light turns, before the light cycles red. When the light turns red, the cameras start taking pictures. And they start by taking still pictures of the vehicle before it's in the intersection, while it's in the intersection, and then it takes a picture of the rear plate. At the same time, there is a digital movie camera that is working that took 6 seconds of video before the violation happened. That's looped, and if there's no violation, then it goes away off into... it's never used again. Then it takes 6 seconds after the violation occurs, so you have 12 seconds of video. Now, an officer who reviews these can run that video back and forth. He can slow it down frame by frame. You can see if the vehicle stopped on the line. We've had cases, people will drive over the line and stop right on the line and they won't move. We won't issue a ticket for that. I wouldn't issue a ticket if I was standing on the corner for that. We've had, however, thousands more drive right through the intersection, and it doesn't matter whether you're standing on the corner or if you're looking at it through a TV screen, that's a red light violation. And so there's an ability to use officer discretion, there's an ability to view the violation in slow motion to make sure that it actually occurred.
So if you can tell if they missed it by maybe a second or something like that.
You can tell to a tenth of a second.
Well, I was thinking, most police officers, if you're just, if you only miss it by a second or something, you're not going to get a ticket normally, they tell me. Would you under this or not?
Well, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't advise doing that in front of me, but... there certainly are, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are limits to... how quickly a person can view events. This technology helps to augment that. We do have limits that, you know, if we say if it's one-tenth of a second, we're not going to split hairs there. It has to be, you know, the violations are so clear-cut that time is generally never a factor.
Okay. Did you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mary Ellen Hay. I'm an assistant Minneapolis City attorney who's been on the Stop on Red case. I would just like to add to Lieutenant Reinhardt's comment and address a comment that Ms. Nelson made. This provides clear, objective evidence. It's very different than the school bus arm. In the school bus arm case, it's a he said, she said. The school bus driver comes in and said, this car did not stop. The driver's going to come in and say, yes, I did. It's a he said, she said. The judge has to weigh credibility and make a determination. In these cases, you have pictures and you have videos. And assuming that the cameras are working properly, and that is part of the evidentiary foundation that a prosecutor would have to lay in court for those pictures and video to be admissible. There are rules of evidence that govern that. They would have to be met. That shows clearly, was the light red? Where was the car? It's better evidence than a he said, she said. And in fact, in our experience in prosecuting these other cases that actually went to court, the referee who heard all these cases had a laptop set up in her courtroom, and she was able to access these videos. And the defendant would come and say, the light was yellow when I went through. Let's watch the video. She would pop it up. They would watch the video. Every one of those cases resolved. We had very few actually go to trial because they watched themselves and they say, I could have sworn it was yellow, but clearly looking at the video, it was red when I entered, and those cases resolved. In a case as such where maybe they enter within a second or something, not only in this kind of a case is there room for officer discretion in deciding to issue or not, there's still room for prosecutorial discretion. Those cases come to the courtroom, the prosecutor sits down, talks to the defendant, and as with any ticket, even if I can see it on a video, if there's a situation like that and I feel there's room to use discretion and dismiss the ticket, that's always possible. There still is the human element. It's not just a look at the video, you either did it or you didn't.
Okay, are there any other questions? We can't move it or anything tonight. Okay, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Colbert, do you want to... You've got three up tonight.
Lucky me.
Colbert.
Chair, what bill would you like to do first?
the only one.
Mr. Chair, how about if we start with 1282, the Department of Transportation data?
Okay.
And I have a phone friend with me here today to the Department of Transportation. I'll go over basically what the bill does and. We'll stand for any questions. It addresses three types of data that...
Representative Colbert, do you want to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1282 for consideration, and I assume to be held over for the data practices on this bill.
Great. Yes.
Thank you. Section 1 of the bill deals with market research data. MnDOT does a number of surveys relative to how people feel about pavement quality, the services provided by MnDOT, and they want the individual names of people that participate in those surveys to be kept private, but rather the summary data then, of course, is public. The second thing is what they're calling the overhead rate data, and this one is a little more technical and may have questions of my testifier, but in order to set rates for contractors, they ask contracting firms to provide information on their rates for service in order for them to set prices that they'll pay contractors. And the third is bid escrow data, and I thought this was kind of unique and seemed to be a really good idea, that when a contractor receives a bid from, is chosen to be the bidder for a project by MnDOT, they ask that they provide in a sealed envelope a delineation of individual line item costs for various components of the contract. And then if there are change orders on the bid,
then what happens is if MnDOT suspects that they're padding the bid, if you will, they can open that envelope to double-check what the line item costs, the various items were in the bid in order to double-check and to keep the prices down on change orders.
I'm sorry, Representative Holberg, what was your witness's name?
Chairman, my name is Barbara Forsland, and I'm the Data Practices Compliance Officer at MnDOT. And I'll be leaving quickly.
Ms. Forsland, go ahead.
Thank you. We've discovered in our market research that when people are aware that their names, addresses, telephone numbers, and associated opinions are available to strangers, that they become hesitant to participate in the market research. We suspect that that type of awareness also might make their opinions less candid and forthcoming. And that's why we're proposing this legislation in the market research area. What's important to note in this area is what is still available. The business question that we're seeking to answer, how we got there, the methodology, the whole vast array of data, just minus the names, telephone numbers and addresses, except for zip codes, the conclusions and what we've done with the conclusions would all remain public. In the second area, which is our overhead rate development, we are one of two states in the nation that has been approved to use this method to control the cost of consultants. Every consultant who does work with MnDOT has to present a full annual financial statement and a list of stockholders to our auditing department. And by careful scrutiny of those documents and application of the federal acquisition regulation rules, our audit department creates two documents, an overhead rate schedule and a schedule of audit adjustments that detail and summarize all the information in the financial statement. Then we apply an approved formula. We take the cost of labor and materials and divide that into the overhead rate that's approved with the removals of things not approved under the federal acquisition regulations. That gives us a percentage, somewhere over 100%. Then we know if a bill comes in, say, that documents $100 worth of time and materials, and that company has 117% overhead rate, could pay would be $117. Of course, the numbers are usually bigger than that. And what we have found is that many contractors who are consultants will have overhead rates in the 200% range, and we pay a maximum of 155%. In fact, we calculate that a 10% change in an overhead rate for a large contractor could represent up to $300,000 in savings from MnDOT. So we're seeking to protect those four documents, the company's financial statement and stockholder list, our schedule of the deductions we're making under the federal acquisition regulations, and our calculation of the formula, although the overhead rate itself would be public. The very same data submitted to the Department of Revenue here in Minnesota is protected, and the very same data submitted at a federal level is protected under the Freedom of Information Act. So we think that we should bring the Data Practices Act into alignment with those various agencies. The third issue that we're seeking some changes on is called the bid escrow data. This is a very unique problem-solving method. It's been in use for about 12 years. The data that the awarded contractor gives includes all of their information about the cost of individual pieces of equipment and individual salaries of employees. And it's subject to very strong protective measures by the contractors. And they believe that sharing this data with their competitors would reveal their marketing and investment and financial strategies and would badly affect their competitive bidding process. Currently, we store that information in a lockbox under contract language. It comes into us in a sealed envelope. It goes to a bank vault. It is not opened unless there is a dispute over a costing issue. For instance, if we have a large removal of gravel and dirt in a project and there's a dispute over exactly how much that should cost, we would open up those documents in the presence of the contractor and see exactly how they negotiated their original cost for the removal. And that's been very helpful to us in resolving financial disputes. Contractors, again, feel that that would be devastating to them if their competitors were able to request it under the Data Practices Act.
Mr. Chair, now that everybody's asleep. Some of them are awake there.
Actually, Representative Holbert, she woke me up.
You had been that bad in here.
Representative Holbert, and Ms., first of all, before we ask questions, is there anybody opposing this? Mr. Neumeister, can I ask one question first and then we'll get to you? All right, that's not right. Mr. Neumeister, come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what's important is that there has to be a very compelling public interest to make things secret. And I can see that in the three of these. Now, first of all, on the first item, one of the market surveys was about rest area progress. There was a survey about the metro area ramp study. There was another marketing done about what they call the Advanced Traveler Information System. I haven't found out what that's in detail, but it has something to do with intelligence of moving traffic or whatever. Now, one of the things that MnDOT does and a number of agencies that they do, they say, hey, this is a great program. 68% of the people believe that we should do this. And what happens? Those kinds of statistics and other kinds of things, people start marching, start putting money, doing all kinds of things. And I think it's important for public accountability to be able to talk directly to those people that may have been participants in those polls, particularly when polls are being used for financial things or to change a policy in which we, in the direction. I'm skeptical of that, and I'm skeptical of other kinds of agencies for these kinds of things. So my point is also is either make it all private or make it all public. And right now it's sort of like halfway in between. So if people want to take a look at the research is done, they got the phone number, and they're going to call, well, is this a, by chance, are you a participant, and who's the person in the house or whatever? I encourage public, there's been no problems with it, and I don't see the compelling interest. On the second item, one of the things that grabs my attention is on page 1, line 17, and a list of stockholders. One of the things that when we do things, when the state gives out billions of dollars, particularly, I don't know if it's that much with MnDOT, but at least hundreds of millions of dollars, you want to see whether or not they're going to different companies that are interrelated or whatever. And one of the ways that one can do is to find out who are members of stockholders. So I'm interested to make lists of stockholders public. Again, for public accountability, and where's the compelling public interest? That list of stockholders, is the world going to end? I can tell you. On the next page, 2-3 through 2-13, I oppose that also. This is a new deal, and I have no problem, as described by Ms. Parker earlier to me this evening, and now the woman before you representing MnDOT. Granted, if there are no questions, no issues about different payments or some deals or whatever that were done, and they're sealed, fine, keep it sealed. But if there is a need for it to open because there is disagreement, I think once that is open, that data should be public. Again, the public accountability, I'm looking for who are the overseers of MnDOT? And MnDOT has had a number of problems and will continue no matter who is governor or who is the head of it or whatever. This is an agency that has been ripped with problems for at least the last 20 years when I started looking at these kinds of issues and when MnDOT has been coming to you to make things more secret and more open. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Ms. Forrestman, I have a question for you. So maybe we can... we're talking about sealing, in essence, the bid data, including computation. This doesn't affect, does it, the certified payrolls that you get on projects that are prevailing wage. In fact, I believe if there's federal money, they're required. This doesn't affect any of that, does it?
Mr. Chairman, no, it does not. Okay. This is totally separate.
Okay. But I have no problem. Did you want to?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you raise your hand before.
I did not raise it before. I was being distracted by Mr. Tennyson, I think. And that why? But it's not like him to be doing that. So. Mr. Chairman,
Senator
members.
Senator Tennyson.
A long time. Senator Tennyson. Mr. Chairman, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. We do have concerns about Section 1 of the bill. The market research classification. I'm not going to repeat what Rich Neumeister said, but I think he made the essential point. The essential point. Number one, government should have some compelling reasons before it seeks to take away from the public information that has historically been publicly accessible. This has been public for many years. I've heard no great problems that have been caused as a result. Government and everybody else in our society uses information to drive policy debates. Some of that driving becomes propaganda. And when the government can generate its own propaganda by doing these surveys and then saying certain percentages of the population of the state support or oppose particular ideas and proposals, shouldn't the public and the media have some ability to monitor what they're doing, to talk to the respondents and ask them if they have in fact taken positions consistent with what the agency is saying. I have no problem. We have no problem in allowing some privacy for home phone numbers, for email addresses. But when you come right down to it, why shouldn't the names and addresses of people who say they prefer ramp meters or hate ramp meters in surveys that are then used by MnDOT to influence state policy, why shouldn't we be able to call them occasionally and say, did you really say this? Is the report that MnDOT has submitted consistent with what you told them? I don't see that that's a big deal. And so we hope you'd oppose Section 1. Thank you.
Our Representative Jones.
What's your response, Representative Fulber, to those concerns to that item?
Well,
Representative Paul,
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, it's always a balancing act in the Data Practices Act, and I tend to fall on the personal end with more privacy. But I think that what I've enjoyed working with this issue over the years is that we can get into some good discussions, and I think that we put the Data Practices Bill together. We'll have some time on the next couple of days to kind of digest what's been presented, and certainly I'll have more conversations with Mr. Anthonson and see if we can make some kind of resolution. But I know for myself personally, I hesitate to give out any information if I don't have to.
Although Representative Holper, to some extent I can see a reason why, as Mr. Neumeister said, to know the stockholders who of corporations that are getting all of the work, maybe some people in the public would be concerned about that type of thing. In other words, if friends of a certain person are getting all the work, their companies, there might be a reason for that to be open.
I think that in the case of the overhead rate data, what they're doing is they're getting costs from a number of companies to try and figure out, you know, what the cost for consultants should be relative to other costs of bringing forward a project. So it's not that they're being awarded a bid per se, but they're trying to set this rate to get information from a number of companies.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I will say...
Oh.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question. This is
for a representative.
Well, when your client newspapers take a poll, will they let members of the public call the people surveyed and ask if they really said whatever you say they said?
I can't speak, Mr. Chairman, Representative, for all the newspapers, but I'm sure a significant percentage would. I could take a poll to determine that. Back to you on the issue. I will say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that we have to remember there's a difference between government and its level of transparency in private business. That's a huge difference. And when private industries, whether they're the newspaper industry or a road contractor, are deciding to do things about state transportation policy, we respect the fact that they have, when government itself starts driving the policy, you have a different issue. I do want to say this, Mr. Chairman. Representative Holberg and the MnDOT folks have been very cordial and pleasant to deal with on this issue. They have not yet yielded to the light of reason, but they've been very pleasant to deal with.
Representative Johnson, you have it. Did you have one? Okay, is there any further? Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
The chair will lay it over for possible.
Please get MnDOT's response.
Oh, okay. I thought.
Very
brief. Very good.
Chairman, concerning the market research, please remember that the legislative auditor would have full access to that data. Any complaints about what we have done that needed to have research into the exact names and addresses of people who contributed could certainly be investigated by the legislative auditor. We do this to reduce our business risk in making difficult decisions, and it's been very helpful to us. There are three professional market research societies, and they all are on record as supporting this type of thing. In fact, they've criticized us for not going further and trying to hide everything, which of course we agree would not be appropriate. But I would like to ask you to consider if the newspapers could get the data, so can anyone else, because I can't ask someone why they want the data. So if somebody came to me and said, show me the data, and they saw that three people on a certain block put their kids on the school bus every morning at 8 and two drivers left their homes and drove on 394 to get over here to St. Paul every day at 8:15 so that we could track the volume of usage and mileage and family usage of cars and high occupancy vehicle lanes, that could be a real threatening situation. And that's why people don't want to participate in market research. In fact, when we started instituting clear Tennyson warnings when I came on board about 2.5 years ago, costs of our market research increased in one case by 30%, trying to find people who would be willing to share their opinions, knowing that anyone for any reason could get access to their data.
Thank you. And the chair will lay this over for possible inclusion, and Representative Holberg, I will give you a warning, a Tennyson warning, that Tennyson is apparently going to testify on one of your bills.
Mr. Chair, I've heard that. Let's take Hostile 1305 next. This is the chorus here, my husband. I understand the DPS is going to be here as well, but... Oh, there's Dana. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1305 to be considered by the committee for possible inclusion in the data practices.
Move House File 1305 for possible inclusion. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, this is continual.
Oh, you have a one.
Yeah, we have a DE1 amendment.
Representative, do you want to move that?
I would move the DE1 amendment to get the bill on the table. We'd like to discuss, and it also helps line the bill up with the language that was approved in the Senate.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Do you want to move that?
I
thought you explained it, but I didn't hear you say it.
That's okay. We've been here a long time today.
All in favor of the DE1 amendment to put it in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Go ahead. It carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is another evolution in the CRIMNET section of the data practices bill. And we have a working group that makes recommendations for policy changes. And Mr. Court has been working with that group. And I'm going to let him explain the issues of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer. I work for the Board of Public Defense. I've also worked for the last 10 years on the Criminal Juvenile Justice Information Task Force. As I mentioned the last time I had the opportunity to speak to you, that task force consists of just under 40 people. We call it Noah's Ark because there are two of everybody, two judges, two legislators, two police officers, two county sheriffs, two court administrators, two prosecutors. I could go on. But, yeah. That group approved this language, which allows
the little guy to be able to find out what information government has on it. Government databases, any database, can chew up the little guy, and the little guy is your constituent and looks to you to protect them. And what this legislation does is use the multi-million dollar investment that the state has made in CRIMNET to help the little guy, because in this case, instead of the wiring going between government agencies, it goes directly to the individual who walks into a police station and says, tell me what law enforcement has on me. Now, for example, you might never have had a personal contact with, say, the Bowabic Police Department, but somebody using your name and date of birth might have. In order to find that information out today, you'd have to go to Bowabic to find out. As a matter of fact, you'd have to go to 1,100 different law enforcement agencies and ask them, anybody use my name and date of birth when they are arrested? What this does is it uses the very same wiring that we've been putting in place to make CRIMNET work to deliver that information on a one-stop basis to an individual who wishes to discover what information is present about that person in the database. So the task force approved this statement, and Representative Cornish arrived at exactly the right moment, being a member of the task force. The task force forwarded it to the policy group that consists of the Commissioners of Public Safety, Administration, the Department of Corrections, and several judicial members as well. And that policy group is represented here tonight by Ms. Dana Goetz from the Department of Public Safety. Speak on behalf of the
Ms. Goetz.
Thanks, members. My name is Dana Goetz, and I'm here on behalf of the CRIMNET Program Office with the BCA. I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Campion tonight as chair of the policy group in support of this bill. As Mr. Sikora indicated, this bill went through the task force process and was ultimately adopted by the policy group. And it's actually one of four provisions contained in the CRIMNET policy bill, which is a separate bill that Representative Hillstrom is authoring. So we are in support of this bill.
And Mr. Chair, it's, we've spent a lot of money developing these databases, hundreds of millions of dollars, and this is just a one way that the public could benefit from all of that investment and being able to check for accuracy of records on them in a more easily, a way that's easy for them.
Representative Colbert, I have a question. My understanding is that there's agreement that one of these bills of yours three tonight is agreed to be in the omnibus data practices, but there's a disagreement on one or two of them as to whether it goes in that.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that the first two bills that we've talked about should be in the data practices bill. The third bill, I believe the one that Mr. Tennyson wants to testify on in the Senate, just went to Judiciary and then to the floor. And it's a little more controversial and probably not best for the data practices.
Did the other two both go into the data practices in the Senate?
So Representative Simon's the chief author of the data practices, so I'm not tracking those things as closely as
I used to. Well, I guess what I'll do is just, unless there's any questions further, I'll lay it over for fun. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I just have one question. When I do my Equifax report for my credit check, they have a little process where if I have any disputes, I have to go through certain steps. Does this have any process or steps?
Yes.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, Chapter 13 does have steps for challenging the accuracy of data and flagging files, and it's a little different from the electronic databases versus the paper files, but there's a very good process.
Representative Holberg, I have a question. If credit scoring, if somebody asked for their report, it goes against them or something, if somebody asked for this information, does anything negative happen?
Well, Mr. Chair, hopefully not. The way that the
do they get put on a list of suspects or something?
Well, Mr. Chair, even if they were to be put on a list, because of the audit features of these systems that we put in place, an individual could track who is looking up information on them, and eventually they'd probably be able to figure it out.
I guess my question was if you wanted to look up something about whether they had something on you.
Mr. Chair,
As far as for private or confidential data, only the data subject or law enforcement with a need to know has the right to access that.
Representative Holber, I understand that. What I was asking is if you go in and ask for information about yourself, does that trigger something that would make you suspect? Why is she looking up to see what they have on her?
Mr. Chair, I thought only Republicans worried about black helicopters.
Representative Holberg, after since Republicans own the credit scoring companies, and they do that, that's why I.
You know, Mr. Chair, I think that certainly in every situation you've got bad actors, but for the most part, I think our law enforcement officials are really quite busy trying to solve crimes and do other things, and I'm going to take too much notice of checking the records for accuracy.
Okay, unless there's further questions, the chair will lay it over for possible improvement in omnibus data practice.
Senator Chair.
Representative Holberg, then I guess you're going to move to 1306.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not aware. I talked with Chair Atkins in committee earlier, and he does not want to see this bill. So as far as from what I know, I think this can go to the floor if the committee so desires. So I move House File 1306 for consideration by the committee. And there is a DE1 amendment. My understanding is that the Senate spent nearly 2 hours on this bill and came up with the DE1 amendment. And so I am moving to DE1 amendment with the hope that
it will
take far less time. But it is my understanding that there are a couple of individuals that are still opposed to this bill, and if we could adopt the DE1 amendment, I'll move forward.
Representative Holberg moves her bill and then moves the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape she wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
What we're trying to get at with this bill, and Mr. Sikora again will be testifying on this bill, is that we have what are called data harvesters, and this testifier will come testify in opposition to this. We'll have a different name for it, but that they go through the public records and collect information in the public realm, put it together, and then through a subscription or payment, make these public records available for the public to purchase. And they're used for a number of things, background checks, landlords use them, etc. And so what we're trying to get here is to make sure that the information that they purchase is kept up to date, and that if there's problems with accuracy, that can be addressed. And initially, as the bill was introduced, it would require that arrest records be deleted if there was no conviction. That's caused some problems. It's got into the expungement controversy around here, and so that issue is backed off of, and you'll see Subdivision 2 is just asking to make sure that these be updated every 30 days to have most accurate records relative to that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sikora.
Mr. Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you know, new technologies breed new policy discussions, and one of the technologies that's been emerging over the last 10 or 15 years is the ability of private entities to grab government-collected data just about free. The Data Practices Act says they can have it for the cost of the media, which means a DVD or even less if it's a direct download. They take that government-collected data and they sell it commercially. What the problem is when you move data around like that, it begins to get stale at the source. The court clerk makes a name correction or a date of birth correction. A judge may order an expungement after a hearing to determine that it's necessary or that it's just. As soon as that information changes at the source, at the master level, all the information that's been copied becomes stale. And when that is sold, it affects people in applications for jobs and applications for housing, an injustice is done. So what this bill does is it requires data harvesters to refresh their data no less frequently than every 30 days, and it provides some steps that an individual can take if they have a question about the accuracy of those data. Again, this is an attempt to put protections in place that pay attention to the needs of your constituents, the little guy. There will be testimony from Senator Tennyson on behalf of one of the data harvesters indicating that they believe federal law preempts this area of legislation by the state. They'll say that the Fair Credit Reporting Act exists and that is a sufficient remedy and exhaustive remedy on the part of the federal lawmakers that preempts states' abilities to legislate. The handout that I provided for you, and if you don't have it, I think I have some extra copies, looks like this. It's landscape printed. And it has some examples of how states have legislated in this area and not run into conflicts with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And I have a list of citations I can give to the House counsel if you wish. I stand for questions at the end of my prepared commentary. Thank you.
Are there opponents to this?
It's
like a couple of them. Is there quite a few coming?
Mr. Chairman,
wait, before you get started, Senator Tennyson, we do have time limits in here. Now, I hope if I cut you off, you don't say what you said to the President of the Senate.
What was that?
Go ahead.
Nobody ever heard me say anything. Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Great Plain and Moody. And I represent Reed Elsevier, which is a publishing company. And among other things, they own LexisNexis, a number of companies that collect information from the public record. We have some issues with the bill. First of all, the bill was initially introduced, as I understood it from the testimony, to help people be reintegrated into society and been in prison or make criminal records. And we think that's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And we think that that should be addressed in a lot of different ways, not just this. The bill, the way it's been revised, I think raises a number of serious issues. First of all, we do think it is preempted by the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and Mr. Scar, being a good litigator, tried to preempt the argument before he's presented by the voters. But the Senate is this issue was raised in the Senate, and for whatever it's worth, the Senate Council was researching the issue and preparing a memorandum for the Senate to deal with this issue. And I don't think the handout you have is a definitive memorandum at all. I can cite some sections of the Federal Act. But first of all, let me explain what the disinformation industry does and why it's necessary for commerce to function, frankly, for a lot of other things to function. We collect data from something like 4,600 sources around the country. The public records, and are used for a lot of purposes, not just employment and housing. Employment, housing, credit, and insurance are all covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So whenever you're dealing with that issue, those issues, the federal law applies, and we comply with that. And that has procedures kind of like this. It also has provisions for actually the state to enforce the federal law. But our records are used by law enforcement. One of our biggest customers is the Minnesota Police Department and Sheriff. Actually, public defenders are also customers of ours. The state is a customer of ours. The University of Minnesota is a customer of ours. We have a lot of customers in the state who use this information for a variety of reasons. Some of us use it to find missing persons. Some of us use it to locate sex offenders, to find missing heirs or beneficiaries or pension beneficiaries. And another important area now with the Patriot Act is the requirement that bankers know who their customers are. So when you go to open a bank account, establish a relationship with the bank, they have to establish your identity. So they're not just John Smith, the John Smith you say you are, they verify whether or not you are John Smith. And it's also used to do background checks when you're engaging in a business transaction with somebody you don't know. You want to find out what their background is. This bill, by saying that you can't disseminate information unless it's up in the last 30 days, is fine and good, but a lot of information is historic information. If you've had a criminal record, I don't know, first of all, we're not sure how you update that every 30 days unless the state provides it. Secondly, in some information, we're concerned about expungement. We don't know what's expunged unless the court notifies us or the individual notifies us. There's no record of an expungement. There's no document that the expungement's in it because it's a defeated purpose. So if we know that, it's excluded, but if it's not. So let me just cut it short here and go to the section of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I draw to your attention, your counsel's attention, because it's the relationship, section 625, relationship to state laws. And it says no requirement or prohibition may be imposed under the laws of any state with respect to any subject matter related here. I'm going to say a couple of them, because there's several of them. And one of which says, related information contained in the consumer report, except that this subparagraph shall not apply to any state law, in effect, on the date of the enactment of the Consumer Credit Reporting Reform Act of 1996. Okay? And it identifies the states that had the law in force at that time. Minnesota got one of those. There's a serious question about preemption. I've asked my client to prepare an extensive memorandum on the issue. I don't have that yet. It's not an easy issue. I went through the Fair Credit Reporting Act. I don't propose to be an expert on it, but I did work through it to try and find out what exceptions would exist to allow the state to do this, and I can't find any. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sarah Janicek for the Consumer Data Industry Association. I'll be brief. First of all, do you hear the theme music from Jaws? Hear it? Is that in your head? I represent all of the data harvesters, who, by the way, lets you make a 30-second phone call at Best Buy and charge a $2,000 plasma TV. Along with Mr. Tennyson, we believe that the law is clearly preempted. It's interesting, this chart that Mr. Sakhar was nice enough to provide to us, this is all existing law. Any adverse information on your credit report has to come off after 7 years. Carla, Representative Bingham earlier referenced the process whereby you corrupt your credit report. Very simple. The credit reporting companies have to do it. I know I do it every year with all big three companies to see if I can still represent them, and they have to by law. The penalties are very severe if they don't correct your record. And with that, I guess that Mr. Anthonson set the precedent that we have to compliment the author we oppose and how cordial she is. So I've done that. Thank you.
I apologize for not getting you here today. I've been at meetings all day, and I just found out last night because we're on the schedule. And there is, as the chairman, as the author said, there is a serious balancing issue here. And, you know, should you make some serious mistakes here, to tell people that they can't report information that's more than 30 days old, but it has been updated. I mean, it contains criminal history. And we can report that information. What is the reporter going to do? What's the bank going to do? They're not going to get the information when they're supposed to find out where they're doing this. Or do you have a criminal record? You're creating a situation. So you're going to create, if this passes, you're going to create a void of the information that's available right now to the public. And I'm not talking about, you know, the efforts that you need to make simply in society, which I totally agree with. What I'm concerned about is you're going to create a situation where you say, we can't report information that we're going to be 30 days old, that's going to correct. Well, we have information that's been correct, but we also have a lot of information that's historical. It's more than 30 years old, it's maybe years old. So I'm not so sure what it means, but anyway, I assume that you don't want to create a situation where you're going to advise the public, businesses, individuals, whatever, some information they need to do out their business because it hasn't been addressed to me. Really addressed to them, and we know it's
well, Representative Tennyson, Senator Tennyson, Representative Holberg, I have a concern about it too. That what are we doing? It seems almost like we're doing the cart before the horse. This assumes the expungement law is going through, which I don't think it's going to happen this year. Senator Moore and I just agreed that we're going to do a lot of study over the interim on very extremely complicated issues. It almost seems that number two is sort of that there's going to be expungements, doesn't it? Or not? Doesn't?
Well, I think it's beyond expungements.
Well, right. But the criminal record was there. And then,
so my concern is that there's no benefit to actually in the legal fight about this thing.
I'm concerned about, we have a lot of housing in North Minneapolis where there's people with, that have been involved in crime a lot. And the neighborhood associations and the landlords are very concerned about making sure that those records pick up everything. So I'm sure that, for me, this is a very wary area where we're going. But I don't know, maybe I'm the only one on the committee that's concerned.
I just have a question for the author. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. What happens, Representative Holberg, in the situation where someone is arrested and then later, for whatever reason, not convicted, whether there's no follow-through in the prosecution or there's an acquittal or whatever, if the record from the data harvesting company or whatever, if it shows the arrest record on there, even though there was no subsequent conviction, is that considered inaccurate for purposes of this statute? In other words, if it was accurate, if the person was arrested, it just didn't turn into anything. How is that affected by it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, the fact of an arrest then would be an accurate record that would be disseminatable to the data harvester and downstream in the stream of commerce.
That would be just. Are there any?
We have a lot of sources of information that are missing. I don't think you can undo I remember when Minneapolis, 40 years ago, the woman I knew was going to college. I went to the president, the president of the United States. I was going to say, not mass. Remember those things, they're in the public record, and it's public record, so you can't just erase them.
Thank you. And what? How do we affect the internet? But Mr. Meister,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a very positive bill. Let's get what the facts are straight under 609A in our state law. First of all, the only convictions that can ever be expunged in the state of Minnesota are those folks like with some drug offenses under 152. And secondly, if I'm 18, 19, or 15, 16 years old and I get certified as an adult, those are the convictions that can only be under state statutory law. The Schultz decision has basically said, courts, you do your records, but state records are going to be, all those convictions are going to be there. This is for arrest, and primarily arrest, because research shows an arrest record is just like a conviction record. And all we're doing here is basically for Rich Neumeister or anybody or any of your constituents that has an old arrest and there's not been a conviction, and primarily a great number of them generally do not, there's no charge or whatever. And primarily we're talking about misdemeanors. Hey, you know, kinds of things that hurt people. People would be able to have a right to get it expunged, but then in the private sector where it continuously hurts them year after year, they'll be able to say, hey, I want some accountability. And what the structure is, what FCRA and what this bill does, this basically says when you cannot verify it in the public record because it has gone through a court process where the prosecutor, the police, and everybody there who wants to testify and the alleged victim to testify say this is no good. But after they go through all that, it gets expunged. All it is making sure that in the private sector it doesn't hurt. This is what this bill does. It's very similar to one in Texas with a couple, some nuances that Texas passed in 203 and 205, and I can share that data with members of this committee. The positive bill, get it on the floor, and then, you know, depending on who documents what, you know, that's the area of preemption. That's another issue.
Mr. Sikora, I have a practical question. The data is put into the computers, et cetera, in the court system. We look those up. If an expungement happens, does that get erased from all of the computers, or what happens?
Mr. Chair, the judiciary doesn't allow me to be privy to their internal processes. From the point of an outsider...
But you go... I mean.
As a public defender, they just don't let me into the inner sanctum.
Okay, but as you're going down the computers for the court system, you see the records. If it's expunged, is it still taken off of the computer, or what happens?
Sure. I understand better your question. In December of 2006, the Council on Crime and Justice cooperated in a project with the Board of Public Defense where we did exactly what you're talking about. We went to one of the major data harvesters, ChoicePoint, and also Westlaw, and we looked at the court record. The Council on Crime and Justice had a project where they did expungements for people who came to them for help. We looked up all of those people's names in the court record, where we didn't find it, and the data harvester at ChoicePoint and the data harvester Westlaw, where uniformly we found records that had been expunged by the court system up to 2 years prior to the date of our search. So, in response to your question, the court record cleared it, but the data harvesters did not.
I don't think you're answering the question.
I'll try again.
Does it show up on the computer? Is it gone from the computer, or do you have to go to some other thing in some file to find the expungement?
It is gone from the computer.
Okay. Representative Westman.
No, pardon me. Representative Holberg had a good point.
And Mr. Chair, unless you're law enforcement,
okay.
And law enforcement generally has the records still exist, and that law enforcement can get to them, but the general public.
I was just worried. My only concern was that they were going to get hit with something that they couldn't catch.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that I don't view this as an expungement bill. I view it as an accuracy bill. And there's nothing in this bill that says you delete out the old stuff. It just says that it has to be updated. So if you're arrested and the case was dismissed, then it would show that the case was dismissed, or it would show that there was never any conviction. I mean, it's not, you can't unring the bell in this game anymore. I mean, it's out there, but if the data stale, you could show cases still pending that had been resolved.
Representative Westman.
Mr. Chair, Governor Moore's comment to testimony talking about the three credit recordings and how this fits together. You can work out, but the current laws for false information on people's records can be against the law, but if you've heard from anybody that's tried to get it fixed, oftentimes, or some of the times, they just quit trying because it's such a complicated system. And in one particular case, I even tried to help constituents get this done. And there is no way to get a hold of any of the credit bureaus. You got to fax them everything, and you hope they've got the information. Then you find out months later they haven't done anything with it, and there's no way to get a hold of anybody. So to talk about the law being already set that you have to clear the report if it's false, well, it isn't very simple. The credit bureaus make it extremely difficult. That's been my experience, and I hear from constituents periodically. So that system has a lot of improvements to be made, and so to say that it's against the law is fine, but nobody's out there helping police it for the consumers.
Okay, Representative, was there any other comments or questions? Okay, Representative Hoberg renews her motion to pass 1306 and refer it to the floor. As amended, I'm sorry. As amended and referred to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next one is apparently a non-controversial one, 655. Can we do this in about 3 minutes?
As the witnesses are coming forward, I just recall what 5 years ago having industrial hemp being made into chips and products and the clothes, and part of that bill samples were brought in so members could get a real feel for the product, and so I'm wondering if that's part of tonight's presentation.
Representative Fundley, are there any free samples?
Floyd, if you call me later, we can discuss it. I talked to you before.
Okay, we'll give 10 minutes to each side, and then about 16, 17 minutes to discussion. Okay, Representative Huntley, do you want to... Finance Division.
Mr. Chair, I can move.
Oh, Representative Bigham, you want to move the House File 655 for...
To Health and Human Service Finance.
Goes to Finance.
Oh.
For passage and referral to the Finance Division. Representative Huntley, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is try to make...
I'm sorry, Representative Huntley, is this your amendment?
No.
Right. Oh, okay, go ahead.
To make the medical use of marijuana legal in Minnesota, the bill requires that you get a script from a physician. So that the physician has to decide whether or not he feels that patient could profit from the pain-killing action of marijuana. It's actually the physician that's on the hook. Physician that's on the hook. If they do misprescribe, they would have to answer to the Board of Medical Practice. It's a difficult thing to do because obviously there's a federal laws that don't allow this, but there are 11 states that have passed similar legislation, and where people can get permission from a physician to use this to alleviate pain. Any of us that have had relatives or loved ones die of cancer, die of other pain-causing diseases, understand what it's like for somebody to go through with unbearable pain. It's my intent to try to help these people. It's not going to be a large number. Colorado has a similar bill, and they only have 200 people that are using marijuana for medicinal purposes. So with that, I'll turn it over to... I will say that there's been some discussion about whether it's actually medically beneficial. There's all kinds of studies that show that it is, and the most recent one is the Journal of Neurology, February 13th, showed a study at the University of California Medical School that AIDS patients that had severe neuropathy and pain were helped by medical marijuana and helped by really nothing else.
Chairman, thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance to represent Huntley to join you tonight. I'm honored to be here with you on this bill. Occasionally, Mr. Chairman, members, in the political philosophies that we have, occasionally the right and the left come together on certain issues. Might not necessarily be for the same reasons or for the same goals. I guess the goal might be the same, not necessarily for the same reasons, but occasionally they do come together. It's not unusual in certain bills that does take place. Members, I'm honored to be here tonight with Representative Hundley supporting what I think is a compassionate way to address some severe pains and nauseousness of individuals late in their life, to do some debilitating circumstances that they have, that maybe only medical marijuana may be of help. I say maybe because let's leave it up to the medical experts. From my position, I believe that good healthcare reform would involve empowering patients and doctors, patients and their physicians. And this is exactly what this bill does, is empowers medical experts. Not you and I, Mr. Chairman, you being an attorney, you being a farmer, but it empowers the medical experts to make decisions that are, I think, very, very important to alleviate some pain, some severe pain with people and their illness. Mr. Huntley said that there are 11 states which have this law currently. I think, Tom, it's now 12. I think New Mexico just passed the bill. I don't know if the governor signed the bill or not. Not yet. Okay, so very, very close to being 12 states. I would want to identify a difference, though, in this bill from at least one of the states, California. There seems to be some difficulty to the law in California based upon the proposition that was passed there. It was a proposition passed by the people, not by the legislature. And this bill is more tightly crafted, much different than the California law, much like the other 11 states. I did some minimal research, members, and I understand that not always do we do in-depth research. I did some minimal research before I became an author of the bill. I did a lot of background reading, read some of the medical journals, looked at some of the articles in medical journals, looked at some of the polls, or at least the polls that have taken place in the states that have medical marijuana. But in specific, called for the states that have medical marijuana, called the law enforcement, certain law enforcement groups in those four states. I think I called the police chief in Denver, I think it was a sheriff in Alaska, I believe a sheriff in Montana, the sheriff's office, and I believe the other one was New Jersey or New Hampshire. I made a call out to a police chief there, just asking them if they had seen any significant concerns to the passage of the medical marijuana bill. The answer in all cases was no, that it really hadn't risen to a point of concern with them. They weren't out trying to repeal the law. They weren't putting significant law enforcement resources towards the medical marijuana bill. Now, in all fairness, in a couple of the states, the law was just a couple of years old, so they hadn't had a lot of experience. I want to be fair in relationship to that. But it seems that some of the concerns that are raised certainly have not come to the surface in the other states, and we're also trying very, very hard, Mr. Huntley, who is the author of the bill, to listen to outside interests that have concerns. Whether those concerns come from county attorneys, whether they come from law enforcement, or members of this committee right here, Tom, members of this committee, listening to concerns you have and addressing those concerns to make the bill even more tightly crafted, so you and I can be assured that the bill will be focused at those who have pain, compassionately to help them, and that the bad people out there that would use it for any different purpose or try to let marijuana become a legal drug, that's not going to happen. I think, in fact, tonight we'll have an addressing some concerns which are coming from law enforcement, basically, in this bill. But, members, members, it's kind of a more of a left and right coming together, which I think is a very, very good bill, and one that Minnesota should become the 13th state to pass.
Okay, there's a couple more minutes left for the pros. Are you one of the Don Hellman or Shannon?
Yes.
Pardon? Your reference, there's a Don Helmont, Shannon Packener. And then, are you new here to testify?
I'll forego my testimony if it helps.
Okay.
Otherwise, I can.
Okay, maybe we can get a 30-second question. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Helmont. For nearly three decades, I have suffered from serious progressive liver disease and other related conditions. About 15 years ago, this illness advanced into the stage of cirrhosis, which is ongoing and irreversible. My symptoms have included anorexia and nausea. Besides that, I have ongoing pain from degenerative disc disease, osteoarthritis, myofascial pain syndrome, and I recently had spinal neurosurgery. But because of nerve-related complications, I now walk with the help of an orthotic brace attached to my leg and foot. Before moving to Minnesota, I lived in California, where voters approved Prop 215. During the 1980s and early 90s, I went through three extended courses of treatment using the potentially helpful but toxic drug interferon. This was unsuccessful. Next, I tried a bunch of prescription medications, Marinol, Vicodin, Percodan, several anti-nausea medications. All these were minimally effective or had unpleasant or even addictive side effects. So my doctor suggested I use marijuana to ease my pain, control the nausea, and maintain my body weight. So I registered as a medical marijuana patient. I was issued an ID card. This allowed me to buy limited portions of the drug from private dispensaries. My eligibility was reviewed and recertified yearly. My doctor and I agreed that marijuana works for me. When I use just a small amount, my body's metabolism has no way of recognizing whether my actions are okay or not under some sort of law. What is clear is that I feel healthier, I look healthier, and I am healthier. This treatment has enabled me to live a more independent and productive life. The bill before you would help me in two specific ways. First, HF 655 would protect me from the risks and dangers of a criminal environment, and it would also help improve the quality and therefore the safety of marijuana, providing a medical alternative many agree is not only more effective, but also as safe as the options that are available legally. In closing, I was born in this region, and I feel that most Minnesotans can accept the use of marijuana for medical purposes, as long as it is done systematically and responsibly. California's medical marijuana law was a start. Minnesota's proposed legislation will be better, and it will provide effective relief for many of us who are very, very ill, and in a manner that is safe for everyone.
Thank you. Mr. Packenham?
Packenham, yes. Good thing I was going to make it here today. Quite a nerve-wracking thing, but Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good evening. I'm sure you don't want to be here this late, but my name is Shannon. I'm here to testify in favor of HF 655, the medical marijuana bill. As an athlete who suffers from a neurologic disorder known as Tourette syndrome, I have used medical marijuana in the past and found it to be the most reliable treatment I have encountered over a lifetime of medication. This is actually the third time I've come to the Capitol to testify in support of medical marijuana legislation. On February 14th, I testified before the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Securities Committee in favor of a Senate version of this bill. I was featured in the Star and Tribune. 2 days after the Star and Tribune ran my story, I received word from my son that he was interrogated during school day by school officials. they want to know whether his parents grew marijuana, whether they kept it in the house, whether they knew people who grew it. Mr. Chair, my son was born with a birth defect that affects his speech patterns and occasionally his comprehension. He didn't know exactly what was going on, except that he was singled out, questioned, treated like a criminal himself. Mr. Chair and board members, let me emphasize that this happened because I came before legislature as a citizen to testify in favor of this bill. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you have the power to make this stop. I should not be a criminal for treating the symptoms of my illness. I'm not a criminal for coming to voice my support for this bill, and my son should not be treated like a criminal on the basis he is my son. Please stop this today. You have the power to protect patients like myself from arrest, jail, and our families from unnecessary hardship. Please vote in favor of this bill. I believe it's a good thing. It would help people so they didn't have to take these heavy psychopharmaceuticals that are needed, haloperidol, things that are destructive to the body, even the medication I had to take to be able to make it here today. What I take, you people wouldn't make it here for 2 days, I guarantee you that. And I function like I do. It doesn't totally alleviate the ticks. So please, you know, have some compassion in your hearts. Look, you know, openly. The one thing that we can use for many purposes without the severe side effects and degradation of the body that many of the pharmaceuticals do. Combination of the adult.
Okay, thank you. Could you take the microphone over to him? And
hello, hello, members of this committee. My name is Daryl Paulson. I've been working on the medical marijuana issue nearly 16 years, so I'm going to forego most of my testimony. You guys have copies of it. But the question before this committee today is very simple. Is it reasonable for the state of Minnesota to lock patients up like myself and other patients just because they are using the recommendations of their doctors? And some of us will face the threat of arrest and privately be responsible, and because we're privately and responsibly using small amounts of marijuana. Even though my doctor knows that this helps me and it helps the other patients that spoke here before you today, is it reasonable to treat us like criminals for using this medicine? I hope and urge your support of House File 655, and I would hope that you show some compassion and support the rest of these patients, like myself, so that they don't have to be prosecuted and have to do community service like I had to do almost 10 years ago. And since that time, I've used Marinol, which is not a very good drug for me to use. It has a number of side effects. So I do use marijuana in conjunction with Marinol from time to time to combat the nausea and the severe side effects that I get, the grogginess and the irritability. So I just urge your support and pass this for tonight, please. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The opponents, I've got six already listed, and we're going to
get the question
afterwards.
We're
going to have a question amendment. You know, our usual, we have the for and the against, and then the questions, comments, and amendments all in one. So, we got about 3 minutes for. We've got six listed. I'll read them off. Gillespie, Weinzettel, Franklin, Fox, Pritchard, and Backstrom. Mr. Gillespie, do you want to come up first, and then we'll just go in that order, and you get about 3 minutes apiece. Sorry, but the committee's rush trying to get through these bills. It's tough at this time of year.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. We represent about 8,500 line police officers across the state of Minnesota. You have my prepared remarks in your packet. I will simply add to that 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 is the position of my association. And as an individual, there's no shortage of compassion in law enforcement. My mother died from misdiagnosis of ovarian cancer by a quack who thought it was gastritis. My sister supervised her passage for 2.5 years. If my sister had told me that marijuana would have eased my mother's suffering, I would have been out on a street corner getting a dime bag and rolling a doobie that would have made Cheech and Chong proud. But frankly, Don, she didn't. And she worked with doctors and nurses to put together a medical treatment that eased my mother's suffering and aided her in her final passage. And with that, I will surrender the microphone.
Thank you for shortening the time, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity to address you. My name is Mitch Weinzettel. I'm the Chief Police for the Buffalo Police Department. I'm also the President-elect for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I'm here representing that organization. The question of whether to legalize marijuana for medicinal purposes is very complex and carries with it broad implications. Immediate and obvious areas of concern include conflicts with existing federal law, the potential for youth access and abuse, and the potential for this action being used as a platform to promote legalization of marijuana on a larger scale. As compelling and relevant as these issues might be, they do not speak directly to the issue of medicinal use. In the United States, the FDA is the governmental body that has the duty and the responsibility to examine and consider which drugs should be legalized for medical purposes. Many pharmaceuticals have been developed which would have saved lives, healed the sick, and otherwise improved the quality of life for many people with chronic pain, fatal diseases, or those who are otherwise sick or infirmed. Despite this, many of these proposed drugs were either not approved by the FDA or were recalled from public use due to potential health risks to society. Since the purpose of this legislation is to authorize the medicinal use of marijuana, it should be appropriate to apply the same logic and due process to this substance as any other pharmaceutical proposed to the FDA. There is no proof of marijuana's medicinal value, although I hear some comments to the contrary. But even if there were proof, the potential value of this drug is overshadowed by the potential societal harm. In short, the needs of the few should not outweigh the potential harm to the general populace. Being a compassionate society, is natural to be moved by the plight of the afflicted, which see this drug as their only escape to their debilitating condition. My heart goes out to them. We must not, however, allow our natural sympathies to blind us from the predictable, harmful consequences which will result from legalizing marijuana for medicinal purposes. Marijuana has been proved to be a harmful drug, and legalizing it in any way will increase the harm of this drug to our society. I urge you to consider federal law, the position of the FDA, and the recommendation of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, along with the other professional organizations opposing this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Weinzettel. Mr.
Yes.
Franklin.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Franklin. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'd like to make two comments, one on behalf of the association, and one on behalf of the comments, if I may. First of all, I think there's a number of problems with this particular bill, the way it's written. There's a number of employment-related issues that are going to come up. The way this law is written right now, we as law enforcement officers are going to have a very difficult time even dealing with a applicant or someone inside of our own ranks that does get use of medical marijuana on the job. You can see the skyrocketing retirements and other kinds of things that could come about because you're going to have somebody that's going to be licensed to smoke marijuana in a law enforcement capacity to deal with that in employment law. We're into an area here that I don't think has had sufficient research, and you're opening a can of worms that I don't think it has any. I don't know where the ramifications for some of these things are going to go. Secondly, I think there's a number of issues here that talk about
registry card. The timetable to get it out the door seems extremely short, and with the fraudulent driver's license that we see, I can only predict that we're going to see a number of forgeries on the street that we as law enforcement are going to try to do. The other concerns that I have, and I'll make my, I can't enumerate those in 3 minutes, I will just tell you, I have queried my counterparts in Nevada, Colorado, Oregon, and California. They, too, have indicated there's been definite criminal activity increased because of the medical marijuana. In fact, one of the states, one of the supporters was just murdered for his stash a short time ago, unfortunately. Additionally, the projection of 200 to 300 people in the state, that now tops over 10, 12, 14,000 in some of these states because these people are getting doctor slips to use medical marijuana. Let me just say on a personal note, I've been down this path. I've had my father, my mother, and my wife all involved with varying types and degrees of cancer. We've been down all these roads. There are medical drugs available that do work. But this is not the only thing in the world that will work. Thank you.
Thank you. The next one was Mr. Fox, or... Not a fox in the room. Okay. Next would be Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chair, I have some handouts.
Okay. Would the pages help hand it out? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we oppose this bill for a number of reasons. First of all, we don't oppose the use of FDA-approved marijuana as medicine. Marinol was mentioned, the active ingredient used to treat nausea. There's also one being tested called Sativex, which is a spray medicine that's being developed for neuropathic pain. We see this as a situation as analogous to the morphine. Obviously, morphine has medical benefits. It's a valuable drug, but the FDA doesn't approve it for smoking of opium and heroin. And we're concerned that what the legislature is basically doing is substituting their judgment for the judgment of the FDA. It's kind of like, ask yourself, would you rather have it use a drug approved by the FDA or one approved by the legislature? And we feel that we need to go with the FDA. In a sense, what the legislature is doing here is affecting the entire state of Minnesota. It was mentioned marijuana is a dangerous drug. Marijuana potency has more than doubled within the past 10 years and is now 20 times the potency of marijuana smoked in the 1960s. So it weakens the immune system. It's addictive. It's mind-altering. It affects memory, concentration. More people are... a person is 5 times more likely to be admitted to an emergency room for marijuana than for alcohol. And it's addictive. More kids are admitted for treatment for marijuana than for alcohol. I think we have to realize that just asking the question of does it relieve pain and nausea isn't the final answer in determining whether to approve a drug. If you look at a drug bottle, it gives you a lot more information in terms of the risks, the benefits, the dosage frequency, the refills, interaction with other drugs, impact on other pre-existing conditions, alternatives. With marijuana, you have none of that information because people don't know. The comments were made that this is a tightly crafted bill, but I think if you look at specific provisions, I believe it's not tightly crafted. If you look at the definition in Section 2, Subdivision 4, if you read into that definition, it says, quote, the definition or what can be prescribed smoking marijuana for, a chronic medical condition that produces pain that has not responded to ordinary medical measures for more than 6 months. That's not extreme circumstances. That is a wide open door for abuse. There's lots of conditions people can have which aren't extreme circumstances, and I think you need to realize that this opens the door for abuse. It also allows for enormous use in productions. Producers can produce between 60 and 300 pounds of marijuana, and I sent you around a picture of just what 50 pounds of marijuana would look like. So you're getting enormous amounts of marijuana produced. There is no regulation on where it can be grown, the quality. It can be grown in somebody's backyard. under Section 2, Subdivision 8, 18-year-old kids can grow marijuana. Just think of the views that can have. It was mentioned there are problems in other states. California, for instance, one psychiatrist has recommended marijuana to 7,000 patients. I've been told in Oregon, of 10,000 recommendations for marijuana use, 6,000 were made by 6 doctors. As I mentioned, this can be grown in the backyard. Register organizations can be established which can produce unlimited amounts, limited only by the number of customers they have. In California, one state official said, quote, "I don't think the voters thought there were going to be marijuana farmers." There's a problem of conflicting with federal laws regarding drug medical devices. These drug paraphernalia will be now classified as medical devices and will be regulated by the FDA. How do law enforcement people sort that out? I think this also puts the public at risk. Right now, 33% of those arrested for reckless driving tested positive for marijuana. 40% of adult males arrested nationwide tested positive for marijuana at the time of arrest. I think that will only go up. There are no restrictions in this bill for possession of marijuana in school buses, on school grounds, on employment places, or in housing or living situations. In landlord situations, there's no restrictions even on the use of marijuana. So you're tying the hands. In conclusion, I think this is a consumer protection issue. I think the legislature should not be circumventing the current process of the FDA to be approving drugs. I think it also has the potential to flood the state with substantial amounts of marijuana. And I think it will make current marijuana laws more difficult to enforce. And so I encourage you to do what's right and not step into the role of the FDA and begin approving what drugs should or shouldn't be legalized or approved in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Mr. Maxwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. James Baxter, Dakota County Attorney, President-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I have corresponded with all of you several times in connection with this issue. I hope that you've had a chance to read through the Minnesota County Attorneys Association's policy position, which documents at great length our concerns with this particular proposal and why we do not think it's in the interest of the safety and protection of Minnesota citizens. I'll just highlight a couple of things quickly. First of all, there is no medication in America that is authorized with a delivery system of smoking. Smoking is harmful to the human body in any form, and it's particularly harmful with marijuana, which has significantly more dangerous chemicals than tobacco smoke. Secondly, I think it's important for you to take a look at the major medical associations in America and think about the fact that the American Medical Association has not endorsed the medical use of marijuana for anyone. The American Cancer Society, the National Sclerosis Association, the American Glaucoma Association, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and the National Cancer Institute. None of these major organizations, which represent the vast majority of individuals suffering from these terrible and debilitating diseases, have endorsed the smoking of marijuana as a medicine in this country. I think that's an important point to make, or to note. Secondly, I guess when you look at this issue from a legal standpoint, it is clear that the law that is under consideration here is inconsistent with federal law. Federal law classifies marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance. That definition, by definition, means that these are the drugs in our nation that have the highest possibility, highest potential for abuse, that lack any accepted medical use, and that have no accepted safety criteria for use under medical supervised treatment. And it's classified as a Schedule I controlled substance for a reason. It is a dangerous and harmful substance, and I would encourage you to consider that closely. I do not believe, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association does not believe, that it's sound public policy for this legislature to substitute its judgment for the FDA in terms of determining what are safe medications to be given to America's citizens. And we are concerned that this drug or this bill, if passed, will lead to the perception that marijuana is harmless, and that in itself will lead to more use by many in our society, particularly our children. And we have grave concerns about the implications that this bill will have on increasing the use of this drug. And those implications, by the way, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, have been acknowledged by the United States Supreme Court in its decision, which clearly indicated that in its ruling upholding the federal authority to regulate this controlled substance, that the distribution of it will increase with legalization for the form of medical purposes as is under consideration here. In short, Mr. Chair, it is not in the interest of the safety and protection of our state citizens to approve the legalization of marijuana for medical purposes. I say that with the full understanding and with, on behalf of my colleagues, with great compassion for those who suffer from the debilitating diseases that this bill is designed to address. But there are safe medications, approved medications, that can be delivered with prescriptions in a controlled way, with the quantities and the quality of the medications controlled, which cannot be done with marijuana. And that, in a nutshell, is the root of the problem. So I thank you for your consideration of my comments tonight and the written materials that I've given the committee before. I had a couple of handouts this evening as well for your consideration. One last point, and I sent this to you earlier by email today. Take a look at the Oregon experience with medical marijuana under a bill which is virtually identical to that which is being proposed here in Minnesota in terms of the definition of debilitating disease. They have over 13,000 now. As of January 1, it was 12,895 persons approved for medical use of marijuana in Oregon. 11,305 as of that date were for severe pain. One of the proposals the county attorneys presented to you, we just adopted it this last Friday, so it's relatively new. We pointed out 23 specific areas of concern with this legislation. I understand a couple of those are addressed or will be addressed, but please take a look at the wording of this bill. It is extremely broad and causes great concern for those of us in law enforcement, and I would urge you to be very cautious and careful as you deliberate this. We urge you to oppose it completely for the reasons articulated. But if it is passed, we urge you to narrow and look at the suggestions we've made in terms of narrowing the focus of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and all the witnesses. Thanks for staying close to your time. Mm-hmm. Representative Olin, I believe you were first. You have
Chairman, I was told that I would have a chance to testify.
Okay, well, they're out of time, but if you can do it,
I'll make it very brief, sir.
Less than a minute, try to do it.
I'll talk fast. Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Oliver Steinberg. I've been following the misfortunes of this bill since, similar ones since 1990. On the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice, I want you to respond quickly to what Mr. Baxton said about the federal Supreme Court decision. It was decided not on the merits of, it's Gonzalez versus Wage. It was decided not on the merits of marijuana as an effective medicine, but on very different grounds, in order to save the elasticized interpretation of the Constitution's Commerce Clause. Don't take my word for it. You've all got this newspaper article quoting Justice Stevens, who wrote the majority decision, who said the outcome of the case was unwise. Justice Stevens said, I have no hesitation in telling you I agree with the policy choice made by the millions of voters in California. Justice Stevens, who wrote the majority decision in Gonzales, said, I was convinced that the law compelled a result I would have opposed as a legislator. Now, as legislators, we can't do anything about the federal law, but an appellate court decision in Minnesota, State versus Hansen, also presents problems. That's the one in 1991 where, by implication, the appellate court concluded that the legislature did not intend and would not allow a defendant to come into court and claim medical need as a need to break a law. Now, you know, we have a law in self-defense. There's been two publicized incidents lately of housebreakers who've been shot and killed. But the killers were not prosecuted because they... May I continue, sir? They had to do it. Okay, they had to do it. They had to avoid greater harm. And the law in self-defense doesn't endorse manslaughter. It excuses it where it's tragically unavoidable. It's ironic that you can lawfully kill another person in this state to save yourself from death or great bodily harm, but you cannot smoke a cannabis cigarette or eat a marijuana brownie for the same purpose. And if arrested, you can't even explain that in court. So I'd like to hope that you will take action that would reverse the effect of the Hansen court decision and not pass a law that could be twisted against the patients, as the THC Therapeutic Act was in the Hansen case. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Representative Olin, your
hand. Yes. I would, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Amendment H.O. 655A13. Explain what it does.
Representative Olin moves A13 amendment. Could you explain your amendment?
Briefly, what this amendment would do is it represents negotiations behind the scenes between the proponents of this bill, the Sheriff's Association, some members of the County Attorneys Association, and other people. The first few provisions of the bill deal with removing any reference to homegrown marijuana. In other words, an individual patient cannot grow homegrown marijuana under these provisions. It removes that part. It does leave in a part dealing with the registered organization being able to grow 12 marijuana plants per patient as an organization subject to all the other rules in the bill. It also goes on further down. It changes a 180 to 90 as far as a penalty provision, because that's consistent with a misdemeanor law. I believe that's why that was done. There is a felony provision placed in this bill dealing with the person who knowingly submits false records or documentations required by the commissioner to certify an organization. In other words, a knowing violation to certify somebody not eligible would be a felony. Going to the back side of the bill quickly, the Board of Nursing requested lines 2.1 and 2.2 be left in for some specific reason that they were interested in, which they could define better than I could. But 2.4 places a sunset provision on the affirmative defense that appears on that page. It would sunset the affirmative defense on June 30th, 2008. And last, the last provisions deal with a registered organization not being able to supply to any person individually any material that would allow them to grow it at home. I think that's basically what the bill does, or the amendment does.
Representative Olin, I think it's my understanding that this is agreed with the authors.
This is the other thing I was going to get to. This is done by negotiations. It's my understanding that the authors are in agreement with this. And it's also my understanding that the authors continue to work with the Sheriff's Association, the county attorneys, and other persons trying to make further agreements on some things they're still having disagreement on.
Okay, so Representative Paymar?
On subdivision 7 of your amendment, are you adding is this adding to the felony penalties?
I would believe that that's what this provision does.
It's adding another felony to it?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's what that amendment does.
Mr. Chair, and I'm fine if this is a compliment of the three parties, but I do think we probably need to have a
fairly quick fiscal note on the bill. It's now we have two felonies in the bill, if I'm reading it correctly.
Yeah, and I was not aware that provision was in my amendment, so I can. It may well require
maybe we can maybe even do that. But maybe we
just. Well, Representative Kamer, does this then have to go to finance?
Well, yeah.
It goes to your finance. Okay.
Well, it goes to finance. It probably go to both of you. Yeah.
You haven't stated that you do agree with this amendment?
Mr. Chair, I not only agree, I accept the amendment. I actually really like it. I think it makes it a better bill and does things in there that make it tougher, and that's the way it ought to be.
Okay, Representative Olin, to the amendment.
To the amendment, question for Representative Olin. If I understand the amendment, you're not touching anything to do with the definition of medical condition for which this can be prescribed. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative.
So it can still be prescribed for muscle spasms or the definition of an intractable, I can't say.
Intractable.
You said it?
Now, these amendments would not touch that medical definitions, no.
Okay, well, then the question I've got is, Mr. Chairman, Representative Olin, I understand what you're trying to do here, but I've had some conversations with you. If we're going to call this pain medication, then why aren't we treating it like pain medication? Why aren't we setting up some type of an organization, a group that will work with the federal and state authorities to actually develop this as a prescribed drug, pain-killing medication that will be handled in the same manner as Vicodin or any other pain-killing medication?
Representative Olin.
That could be a possibility, but it's not a consideration at this time.
Representative Farnish?
Mr. Chair, you mentioned the Sheriff's Association. I would like to know if the other law enforcement agencies here, if they were in any of this bargain, what they think of it.
Yep, they're all looking at each other. Mr. Weinholz or Weinzettel?
Close enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have been in discussions. The our position is that you can do this to us, but you can't do this with us. We're concerned about this across the board. We continue to hear about compromises and things that people feel paint a brighter picture, but a dud is still a dud. No matter what the bill looks like and all of the adjustments that you made, it's a bad bill and it's bad policy. And we certainly like to work with the legislature in whatever way we can, but this is an area where we don't feel a compromise is in the public interest or in law enforcement.
Mr. Weinzel, I guess the question would be, do you oppose this amendment or do you just oppose the bill?
I believe the question was whether or not we were in discussions about the discussions, and my understanding there were more things discussed than this particular amendment. I haven't seen all the amendments that are floating around. There have been discussions with our lobbyists, with our association, and again, discussion certainly does not mean that we're acquiescing and agreeing. So we have discussed it, proposed the bill.
Okay, I guess they don't take a position on that. We're
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gillespie, and I feel like the first baseman who thinks the catcher and the pitcher is talking about him. But we haven't had the discussions. We're not privy to it. It's still a bad bill. The message is what we're opposed to, the message to our youth that marijuana is cool, that marijuana has some medicinal value. And so it's just a different shade of lipstick on a bad thing.
I guess there's no further discussion on the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Move.
Okay, the amendment carries. Further discussion. So everybody's tired. Okay. Representative Westrom.
So just to follow up now with the new language, Representative Olin, is this still going to be dispensed through growing it and licensed? No pharmacy, no nothing.
Representative Walden.
Representative Westman, can you please repeat the first part?
I missed it. Will this still be dispensed in the same manner under your amendment? You're not opening up or moving towards a pharmaceutical process of a pharmacist being the gatekeeper versus just a licensed grower?
No, I did not address that, Representative. It would be addressed as a registered organization. I did what I thought was a request of law enforcement, county attorneys, and some of the things to correct this. Now, I'm finding out that they're not backing that, which just makes me a little dissatisfied, because the reason I brought this amendment is I thought this did help that situation. And I want that known on the record.
So you want to go back to the other
provisions? No. I believe it helps the bill, but that's the reason I want it known.
Mr. Chairman, can I bring some clarification to it?
Yes, Representative.
Just take me 10 seconds to clarify. These amendments that Representative Olin is offering is a reasonable effort to try to address some concerns that were been brought to us by law enforcement officials and by county attorneys. I think that there is no problem with the amendment as brought forward. I think that they still oppose the bill. I understand. I recognize that. But there are other issues that are left on the table for discussion, because there's a significant interpretation differences as to what is in the bill and what's not in the bill how it relates to current law. So there'll be continued discussions go on, but I don't think anybody would be against Representative Holmes' amendment to his brought forward.
No, Representative Swigum, we adopted the amendment.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have some questions for both sides, because it's a tough issue. But in terms of the proponents who are here before the microphone, a couple questions. First of all, I understand that under federal law, it would still be illegal to distribute or manufacture. I know that there's an exception in federal law now, I'm told, for certain private uses, but it would still be illegal under federal law to distribute or manufacture. So I don't quite understand it under this bill. Who's going to grow this stuff? Who's going to create it? And aren't they taking on the risk that there might be a raid, a federal raid, at some point? I know it hasn't happened in other states, but...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
state your name,
please. Neil Levine. I'm the director of Minnesotans for Compassionate Care. Yes, that what the basis of this bill is because we have a federal law, the current federal law that we have, 11, soon to be 12 other states have adopted this exception to the federal law because of the overwhelming body of evidence that's accumulating that marijuana has medical purposes. And what we have is we have people in this state and a lot of states using marijuana to alleviate their pain for some very serious illnesses, and they have to deal with the threat of arrest or just trying to alleviate their pain under the recommendation of their doctor. So what this is doing is, since 99% of state and local marijuana, 99% of all marijuana arrests made at the state and local level, the state level laws are very effective. And so what we're the aim here is to protect these patients from the threat of arrest and let these decisions be made between a doctor and a patient. Under the bill, a doctor has to certify that the potential benefit would outweigh the harm and then give that recommendation, which then the Department of Health will have to certify. And this is how it works in many other states. So yes, there is the federal conflict. That's the point of the state of Minnesota having to pass this. The head of the DEA, Karen Tandy, has stated that the DEA will not be in the business of going after patients. There have been raids in some of these things before, and that would be a risk. We acknowledge that there's the federal conflict. Some previous people testifying this bill keep mentioning the FDA and Schedule 1 of marijuana. The DEA is actually responsible for scheduling marijuana, not the FDA. And a DEA administrative law judge back in 1988 ruled that there is a preponderance of evidence that marijuana has medical value and requested the DEA reschedule marijuana to a Schedule II drug, which, by the way, that's where meth is and that's where cocaine is. According to the federal government, marijuana is more dangerous and deadly than cocaine and meth. So So that's the problem we have in the federal law, and the DEA ignored, they chose to ignore that recommendation because the administrative law judge recommendations are voluntary. The head of DEA does not have to follow them. So there is this conflict, and that would be the point of law.
Mr. Chair, I just have a follow-up. I still don't understand, though, who's going to grow this stuff. I understand that there's a conflict. I understand what you're attempting to do. What I don't understand is who is producing it, who is distributing it, who is growing it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. I didn't answer that part of the question. The amendment that Representative Olin just made took out the homegrown provision. So under the bill, it would have to be a nonprofit organization that would register with the state of Minnesota who could grow up to 12 plants for every patient that registers with that nonprofit. So under the bill, a patient can designate two caregivers because a lot of patients are bedridden and or what have you. So one caregiver would be designated as a set nonprofit. Another could be an individual who can help them get the marijuana. So the nonprofit would grow the marijuana specifically for the patient. They could only grow enough marijuana to meet the patients who have registered with them, and that would all run through the health department registered in the state. So a patient could only go to their designated nonprofit.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, I just want to say that I value the work of our law enforcement folks around the state and what they're trying to do. But to this bill, I just really agree with the authors and just the compassionate nature of this and having it be, like Mr. Swigum said, between the patient and the doctor, and just talking really about the compassionate side of this. We've heard some other, like, personal stories, and I think we all have them, but I just, you know, a long time ago, in the early 80s, my mom came down with cancer, and so I was going to school in 1982 in England, and during that process, they said, well, you can do some they expected us to do volunteer work. Well, it just happened to be that because of my mom and the cancer was kind of new right then with our family, it wasn't really malignant at that time, but I just didn't know anything about it. Well, one of the options that we could do is work in a hospice. So I went to work in the second hospice in the world in Nottingham, England. I mean, it was early on, 82. These things were just getting going. So I've been involved with this process and the hospice kind of situation throughout my, you know, till the present, and I just really see the value of it. And my mom later suffered and, was in a lot of pain and died. But I don't know if she would have chose to do this either. I don't know. She was heavily medicated. And, you know, we all have these stories. But to me, it's just it's one extra tool in your toolbox. That's what it's about. It's having one extra tool that can be available for other people that, you know, help make it bearable. And, these people aren't going to, you know, there's some different things that were brought up about, the cancer and some of the addictions. I mean, when you're in hospice care, I mean, you're going to live 14 days. Who really cares if you're going to be addicted or not? I mean, so it's, some of that's a little different. And this is coming from me. I've been dry. I'm a dry person. I've been dry for 19 years. So don't tell me, it's just kind of, coming from that side of it. I just have a question. I can't quite get my arms around Mr. Backstrom's, the county attorney, and I just have a quick question for him if he would be willing to come forward. Mr. Backstrom, I'm not an attorney, so we've got all these attorneys. They could probably, and of course you're a county attorney, so I never could lead you, but I am going to try to some degree. So I have a prop that's going to come out later on. So it's in this bag, but I can't use it on the floor, so I'm going to use it tonight. So you talked about the FDA, okay, right? And you talked about safe and controlled substance. So is there other things that doctors might recommend to a patient and say, hey, maybe you need these things. And why aren't you out there fighting for these things as well?
So, Mr. Chair, there's a long list of approved medications to treat the types of concerns. They're listed in the position paper the County Attorneys Association adopted. There's, you know, multiple different medications available. So we certainly endorse those. And by the way, I also, Mr. Chair and members, you know, support the continued study of this particular issue to see if there are any way that any usable forms of marijuana can be taken out and delivered to a patient in a safe way. Smoking simply isn't a safe delivery method for medication.
Well, I'm going to bring these out, and they're kind of fun. You know, I'm getting older. I'm 45 now, and this was brought to me by another gentleman, but these all fit for me, too. Here's fish oil. It's, you know, it's kind of good for your heart. Is that approved? I don't think it's approved by the FDA. And the doctor recommended that to the patient that gave it to me. Here's one-a-day pills, and that's not approved by the FDA, and that was recommended by a doctor. So we've got that. I have two more, so... Oh, well, maybe you're not, your joints aren't sore, but I throw luggage. My joints are sore. So here's the kind of help as we're aging a little bit with our joints. And then I got one more. I don't know if you have prostate cancer or anything in your family, but I lost a grandfather to prostate cancer. And they recommend, this isn't for me, this is from a friend, but I should be taking this too. This is for prostate cancer. None of these are recommended by the FDA. So you know, it's not a perfect world. We're all trying to, you know, do the right thing up here. Anyways, I think it's a great bill. I want to thank the authors for bringing it forward. I want to thank the people that are working on amendments to make it a better bill. And I just think that we need to think outside the box a little bit and care compassionately about some of these other people.
Mr. Chair, just one comment, if I may. One thing you'll note, I believe, on all of the medications that or substances that you put out, there are warning labels. There are issues in terms of identifying the quantity, the quality of what's inside those bottles, and some warnings about a potential danger. None of that is available with marijuana because it's impossible to have those types of warnings.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. I don't talk very often here, so I'm just going to kind of go after this, but. On the back here it says, this statement has not been evaluated by the FDA. I mean, this product, you know, isn't approved. So you have doctors out there recommending it and it's not approved. So,
Representative Parrish.
I don't know if it's a question, but the testifier that came up, the blonde guy with Tourette's, made a statement about these drugs that wreak havoc on people. And I just wanted to say that over the years, in my 27 years of law enforcement, one of the biggest drugs that wreak havoc on people was marijuana in a lot of ways, and their heredity and the way they treated their kids. And so many dives I went into the marijuana, and then that's how it starts out. Marijuana is a precursor to some other drugs that helps people. It graduates from there. So marijuana is one of the most harmful drugs, in my estimation, that I've seen in my career in law enforcement. And the other thing is, nothing gets doctors. I think it gets doctors to write home drug prescriptions if you want to. They need to prescribe just about anything. And in my career as a game warden, these people would go to a doctor for a disability permit.
Yes.
And they described something that they had, and they wouldn't even examine it. They just write one out because they felt sorry for them. They would go to get a crossbow permit or a vehicle permit to shoot from a car. And you go and you just complain to the doctor. They don't want to, you know, they're full of sympathy. That's why they got the job. That's why they're there. They'll write out just about anything. So I don't really feel comfortable with doctors being the gatekeepers to a dangerous drug. And so I just encourage the members here to vote against the bill. That's my story.
Okay, Representative Kimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Levine, you had referenced an administrative law judge or something a few years ago.
Administrative law judge in 1988 ruled that recommended to the DEA that marijuana should be rescheduled to Schedule 2, and DEA ignored the recommendation because those are not binding rulings.
Well, but you, Mr. Chairman, you also followed it up, and my read was you were you don't have the same perspective on the drug that, for instance, Representative Cornish has just described, the dangers or that some other folks have, the fact that it is a recognized gateway drug and it leads to other very serious things. Could you tell me, because you added a statement that there's this body of medical evidence to support this, could you cite specific studies, that sort of thing, that I can reference?
Mr. Levine?
Mr. Chambers of the committee, first off, I'd actually disagree that it's accepted that marijuana is a gateway drug. Just as that, in 1999, the Institute of Medicine wrote that despite a large amount of research that there is really little to no evidence to show that marijuana is a gateway drug. In 2005, the RAND Corporation, in a study commissioned by the British Parliament, said despite copious amounts of research, there's little evidence to show that marijuana is a gateway drug. You know, if you want to show me a heroin addict or a meth addict and say that they smoke marijuana in their life as well, I don't find that as a surprising statement, but the vast majority of people who use marijuana do not go on to heavier drugs. There's about 100 million Americans who have used marijuana in their lifetime, and only about 5 million people have used heroin, 2 million who have used cocaine or meth. So I just want to state that I disagree that that's a factually correct statement, that this accepted as a gateway drug. There has been, we've heard about this FDA statement, Mr. Backstrom specified about it a couple of times, from 2005, that stated that there's no accepted medical research on marijuana. That FDA statement was widely panned in over 20 editorials in the medical community as being a political, not a scientific statement. And since that statement, there's been over a dozen studies. The most recent, which was published here in St. Paul, the medical journal Neurology, is a double-blind study at the University of California that took severe pain that there is no FDA-approved treatment for AIDS patients, and said that essentially that the marijuana was incredibly effective for helping alleviate their pain. There was a study from the University of California a year ago where the purpose of the study was to try and prove that habitual marijuana smoking caused lung cancer. And they did a study of a large amount of long-time marijuana smokers, and they actually found that there were no higher incidence of lung cancer in long-time marijuana smokers compared to people who were not long-time marijuana smokers. In fact, the author of the study was actually shocked that he said there might be actually a protective effect from the marijuana and encouraged further research along these lines. So there is this large growing body of scientific evidence, and unfortunately, unlike other controlled substances, the entire supply of marijuana in this country is controlled by one organization, and there have been individual researchers who have been trying to get their hands on higher-grade marijuana to do experimentations, and those efforts have largely been blocked by the DEA. There was just a professor from the University of Amherst in Massachusetts, just won an administrative law judge ruling again, administrative law judge ruled that he was being unfairly denied access to growing marijuana for medical tests, and he should be granted that access instead of just using the government supply of marijuana. And again, those are non-binding rulings, so the DEA has yet to act on it. So unfortunately, we have a growing body of evidence and a federal government that is, I would say not ignoring it, but actively looking to go the other way. And so that's why we have these instances of all these states passing these laws to protect their citizens, if that answered your question.
Just one follow-up, short question.
One more short question.
Mr. Levine, so would your position be that there should be no regulation on this sort of a substance because it apparently poses no danger?
Yes or no?
No. No, I do not believe that.
I wish you can do it real.
No, I believe that what we have here is a pretty tightly crafted bill that has responsible regulations and penalties for abuse, and I believe that this is good public policy for the state of Minnesota.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In the interest of time, I just have two brief questions. Is Mr. Backstrom still here? Or did he say, is
Mr. Backstrom.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Backstrom, you and a number of witnesses noted that there are, in your opinion, substitutes to marijuana in terms of relieving some of these medical symptoms we've been talking about, but there or many states that have years of experience and duly licensed medical professionals in all those jurisdictions, thousands of them, I believe over 2,000 in Oregon alone, have put their integrity on the line and signed recommendations stating that they believe that the medicinal value of marijuana outweighs the potential harmful effects to the patient. And I'm wondering, I find it telling that we haven't heard any testimony, at least in this committee, from medical professionals opposed to this bill. Why is it, you know, what do you know, sir, respectfully, that these many thousands of physicians apparently don't know when they prescribe or at least recommend medicinal marijuana? I'm trying to get a handle on it.
Mr. Baxter, fairly short.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, there are, I do know that there are many physicians that do not agree with the statements. Obviously, there's some disagreement. But I would just point out, again, take a look at the major medical organizations in America, the AMA, the American Medical Association, that represents all the doctors of America, has not endorsed the medical use of marijuana. I think that's a very important statement to remember.
And Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up from Mr. Backstrom. As I mentioned, Mr. Backstrom, we both know that there are states with some years of experience, and we heard some fears from law enforcement community, and I have read the O2 GAO study, and I'm wondering, can you or any folks from law enforcement point me to any studies or empirical data that explore the link between medicinal marijuana and violent crime, for example?
Mr. Baxter.
Well, Mr. Chair and representatives, I think the concern from a law enforcement perspective, and I think it's a significant concern, is that the passage of a bill of this nature will increase the quantities of marijuana available. It'll lead to individuals to think that marijuana is harmless when it in fact is not. And that in itself will increase the use of marijuana considerably, and that is a concern from a law enforcement perspective.
The last one is Representative Simon.
Well, okay. First, Mr. Basham, don't we already send a mixed message when it comes to other prescribed pharmaceuticals? And here's the mixed message with respect to Percocet, Vicodin, all the rest. The mixed message to kids is, hey, kids, for medical purposes it's okay. For recreational purposes, it's not okay. That exists quite well, right now. We there's a dual purpose. It's a completely mixed message, no question about it. Okay for some purposes, not okay for others. How is that any different? Other than that, and I know it's a distinction, but probably one without a difference, how is it different other than that it's not, that the DEA has put it on the list? Other than that, just as a matter of substantively speaking, how is it a differently mixed message than what we already have with prescription medications?
Mr. Chair, representatives, the difference from my perspective is a very significant one, and that is that those medications are controlled in terms of the quantity, the quality of the availability of the drug. It can be regulated through a doctor's prescription, which will identify the quantities that can be used. Can it be used illegally? Yes, it can. But that shouldn't, you know, you cannot control the quality, you know, quantities of marijuana, because there's no way to do that.
Okay. We are going to vote. I have to repeat. The motion is... Was Representative Paymars, wasn't it? Oh, that's right. It was so long ago. It's Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, we'd ask for a roll call, too.
Okay, the roll call has been asked. The motion is to pass as amended and refer to fines.
Finance. Understands.
Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Chairman Mullery.
Aye.
Bigham.
Yes.
Cornish.
Nope.
LaForest.
Yes.
Emmer.
No.
Hillstrom.
Yes.
Holberg.
No.
Johnson.
Yes.
Halen.
No.
Coles.
No.
Kranz.
Yes.
Flesch.
No.
Lilly.
Yes.
Olin.
Yes.
Hamer.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Simon.
Yes.
Smith.
No.
Westrom.
No.
Well, 11 to 8, it passes.
Next item is the House File 1019. Quiet, we have business to do. We have to go on just because the audience wants to talk. Please do not talk while you're leaving the room.
Okay, Representative Olin, your bill is up. Representative Olin, I assume you move it, and I believe this one goes to the floor as well as... So I would anticipate, Representative Olin, you move the 1019 bill for passage and
I'll also, Mr. Chairman, pass out a D1 amendment, and I'll move the D1 amendment, which is basically a delete all and revise.
Okay. Representative Olin, at this time we're not going to wait. Why don't you discuss it? Representative Olin moves the D1, and you will do this together in the shape you wanted in.
That's correct.
Okay, all in favor of getting it in the shape by passing this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Olin, explain your amendment.
Basically, what this amendment would do is it would make any person under the age of 16 not have to register unless they either when they commit a criminal sexual offender offense, unless they happen to have a prior on their record, or the judge or the county attorney deems it appropriate that they should have to register. It does not handle the 17 and 18 year olds the way the amendment is written. There's some discussion behind the scenes, and that's my amendment only deals 16 and under. And I'll turn it over to Doug Johnson at this time to testify.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Johnson. I'm the Washington County Attorney. I'm also the former Wadena County Attorney. I'm a former past president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I'm a present board member. And I'm also the current co-chair of the Juvenile Committee of the Association. Much of my legal career has been spent in juvenile court, mostly prosecuting, although a little bit defense. I've lost track of how many juvenile sex offenders I've personally prosecuted. This proposal comes from the Juvenile Committee. Purpose, quite simple. Juveniles who are under age 16 would not have to register if they commit a sexual crime with a victim and the offense is because of age difference. We are not deleting those cases where fear of imminent great bodily harm is present, where a dangerous weapon has been used, personal injury to the victim, there's force or coercion, or the victim is mentally impaired, mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless. The vast majority of the juveniles that I see in juvenile court who have committed sexual offenses are one of two. Those who are experimenting, or those who are victims themselves. The treatment people tell us they are very treatable. Here's the problem. Some judges don't believe that these juveniles should be registered. Therefore, they withhold the adjudication. The problem with that is that the court then only has 6 months of jurisdiction. Treatment programs usually take at least 12 months or more. So what we see then are juvenile sex offenders who are not getting treated. Because of the desire not to have kids registering, believe it or not, it's causing victims problems. How? Because some juveniles who would normally agree to admit in court will take the case to trial so that if they win, they will not have to be registered.
This forces young victims to have to testify. I've had to put 5 and 6 year olds on the stand to testify. We can do it. We don't like to do it. Now, I've gotten some numbers from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They say that the Supreme Court's numbers say that judges are not refusing to adjudicate. But here are the numbers that I've gotten from the BCA. Between 2000 and 2006, there are over 3,000 juvenile criminal sexual conduct cases filed in juvenile court. The BCA only has a little over 1,600 registered juvenile sex offenders. That means that there are over 1,400 juvenile sex offenders who were charged, and I don't know where they went, but they're not registered with the BCA, and I can't believe that almost over a third of our cases that are charged go down the tubes with not guilty. We also have some counties that are trying to avoid the registration through the charging process. I know of at least 2 counties where they're charging all their cases dealing with age differences as gross misdemeanors, which does not require registration. At least 1 county is waiting 6 months for disposition with the juvenile going into treatment before disposition, and then they're withholding adjudication so they have the kid under control for 6 months. Why do some people think that registration is bad? Well, first of all, right now, registration of juveniles is private, confidential. You can't get it. But anytime the legislature wants to change the law and make those open and put them on the internet or whatever, you can do it. The other problem I see is that the juvenile record with registration follows a juvenile into adult life. For example, you have a 12-year-old who is charged with a sex offense, is registered. He then goes off to college 9 years later, doesn't give his new address, and now he can be charged with failure to register in adult court. The other problem we have is that we who have been in juvenile court recognize the reason for juvenile court. There's a difference between adults and juveniles and their criminal behavior. And making juveniles register does not recognize the difference between adult and juvenile behavior and their brain development. We who work in the juvenile justice system and with juvenile sex offenders are in favor of the bill. Every judge that I've talked to is in favor of this. The prosecutors are in favor of it. This passed our juvenile committee unanimously. It passed our board unanimously. The public defenders are in favor of it. The probation officers are in favor of it. And the therapists are in favor of it. Registration of juveniles who commit sex offenses due to age difference, it accomplishes nothing. There's no evidence that even one juvenile that has been registered has ever been identified as a result of a subsequent crime. Furthermore, it is a hindrance to treatment. As a prosecutor, it's my job to accomplish justice. And that's why I'm here tonight, because I believe that passage of this law, or this bill, will accomplish justice. Thank you.
Is it Ms. Rickman?
It is. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here also as co-chair of the County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee, and I have actually testified on a number of occasions in support of a bill like this, or this particular language. I think it's... the message that I would like to add, in addition to what Mr. Johnson has said, is that very often this legislative body paints with a very broad brush. And I do not believe that when passing laws relating to criminal penalties, that very often we think of 10-year-olds being covered by them. I have a hard time believing that anyone who could sit in a juvenile courtroom looking at a 10-year-old could seriously think that in all circumstances, this juvenile should be required to register as a predatory offender. Juveniles are not mini adults. juvenile court recognizes, was designed to create it, and must continue to recognize the unique capabilities and characteristics of the juveniles that we deal with. Without that recognition, we lose the very fundamental nature of juvenile court. I'd like to also reiterate that what I see as a prosecutor, and I prosecute, I'm in charge of the juvenile delinquency unit of the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and my one of my primary responsibilities is to review all of these cases. Most often, the cases that I see involving juveniles under the age of 16 are themselves victims, and they are patterning the conduct that was perpetrated upon them. And I reiterate what Mr. Johnson said. This is a just and right thing for us to do. It does not eliminate the possibility that some of these offenders would be required to register. Rather, it turns over to a judge and a prosecutor the idea that in certain circumstances for non-force, non-coercion cases, the court could make the decision about whether registration is appropriate. And we believe that the proper place for that decision to be made. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Stewart. I'm the Minnesota State Public Defender. I've been in this job now for 17 years, but prior to that I was a public defender in juvenile court in Hennepin County for 10 years. I've served on five statewide juvenile justice study groups over the years. We support this bill because it does take into account that not all these kids are the same, and it adheres to the basic concept of juvenile court, which is that the judge is in a good position to sort out which kids are dangerous and need extra controls on them, and which kids can best be rehabilitated. So met with the chief public defenders around the state about this last Friday. We support.
Is there any opponents to this? Okay, then it's open for discussion. There's any discussion? Okay, everybody's pretty tired. Okay, I think we all are. All in, the motion is to pass as amended to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Carried.